You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Mel Duncan. Mel Duncan is a co-founder and the current director of advocacy and outreach for Nonviolent Peace Force, an international non-governmental organization that provides direct protection to civilians caught in violent conflict and works with local civil society groups on violence deterrence throughout the world. He has received numerous awards. The Utney Reader named Duncan one of 50 visionaries who are changing our world. The American Friends Service Committee nominated Nonviolent Peace Force for the 2016 Nobel Peace Prize. Mel Duncan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, it's good to be with you today.
It's great to have you on. We should have had you on before now, and I'm delighted to say that you've agreed to come and speak at a conference in Washington, D.C., being organized by World Beyond War in September called No War 2016, and people can find that at worldbeyondwar.org. Tell us what Nonviolent Peace Force does and what unarmed civil protection is.
Go. Nonviolent Peace Force provides direct protection to civilians who are under threat of war and persecution. We have a team of well-trained, unarmed civilian protectors who are invited to areas of violent conflict. And while there, they carry out a variety of nonviolent strategies that have been shown to work to protect civilians and also work with local groups on violence deterrence. And this work is so important at this moment in history because in mid-June, the UN High Commission on Refugees issued their annual report that showed that 65 million of us fled our homes because of war and persecution over the past year. More people are displaced by war for longer periods of time than any time since World War II. And tragically, it is getting worse.
And when we look through that list of leading countries from which refugees are fleeing and which have internally displaced persons, most of it lines up pretty well with the countries that the United States has been waging wars in, does it not?
Certainly with some of them. If we look at countries like Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq, we can trace the U.S. invasions there and the U.S. military operations. And in Syria, their support of rebels who have been doing some pretty horrendous things, we can trace that to U.S. foreign policy. In other areas, there's not such a direct connection. For example, in South Sudan, where the U.S. is involved, but not nearly as much as some other countries, places like Burundi, places like the Central African Republic and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, also are major contributors to the refugee crisis that we face right now.
And so in what countries does Nonviolent Peace Force work, and what does that work look like?
Our largest project is in South Sudan, where we have a little over 200 people who are working in 10 locations around the country. This is a country that lapsed into a civil war about 2.5 years ago, after about 6 years of relative calm. It's also the newest country in the world and arguably the poorest country in the world. And a civil war broke out between two political rivals primarily, and all of this is fueled by geopolitics on on one level, and then ethnic divisions are exploited on another level. And so millions of people have been displaced, and tens of thousands have been killed over the last 30 months or so. So an example of the kind of work we do, David, comes in areas that are known as protection of civilian areas. These are areas where people have fled and are congregating in proximity of UN compounds to try to gain some type of security through proximity. We have a team of about 50 unarmed civilian protectors in a place called Bentu in the north, where now there are over 100,000 people who are living. Each day, women have to leave those areas to collect firewood. And because now they've been there for over 2 years, the immediate surroundings are pretty well defoliated, so they're having to walk as far as 10 kilometers into the bush. Cadres of government soldiers and rebel soldiers will lurk and will gang rape the women. This is part of a military strategy where increasingly rape is becoming a weapon of war. What we have found is that if three or four of our unarmed civilian protectors accompany 20 to 30 women, the soldiers look the other way. They leave them alone. This has been 100% successful for over a year now. So that's one example of the kind of work that we do. Another example is to have teams, and our teams in South Sudan come from 26 different countries, to have teams in areas that are vulnerable to attack. Because we find that if our teams are there, they serve as a deterrent. So another example, we had just two, in this case, men, although I want to emphasize that half of our civilian protectors are women, and that's very significant. But in the story I'm about to tell you, it was two men, a fellow by the name of Derek from the United Kingdom and Andreas from Mexico. And they were with 14 women and children when the area where they were with these people was attacked by a militia. They took the 14 women and children into a tent and stood in the doorway while people outside were being shot point blank. On three occasions, rebel militia came to Andreas and Derek and pointed AK-47s at their head and said, "You have to go. We want those people." And on all three occasions, very calmly, Andreas and Derek held up their Nonviolent Peace Force identity badges and said, "We are unarmed, we are here to protect civilians, and we will not leave." After the third time, the militia left, and the people were spared. So those are two examples of the kind of work that we do in South Sudan.
And wonderful examples, and risky examples. Have you had anyone hurt or killed in working for Nonviolent Peace Force?
We have been in the field now for almost 13 years. And during that time, we have had four conflict-related injuries. Five. Five conflict-related injuries. Three of which were accidental, and one where one of our civilian protectors was kidnapped in Mindanao in the southern Philippines and was held for 111 days, and he was injured during that time. And then in December, one of our women protectors was thrown to the ground by a soldier and had a gun held to her head, but her teammates interposition themselves and were able to have the talk the soldier off. So those are our five injuries that we've had. And while we do accept that what we do does involve a fair amount of risk, we mitigate those risks because we aren't there to make martyrs of ourselves. The strategy of stopping a bullet only happens or is only successful once.
Yeah.
And life is precious to us. The lives of the people we're working with, but also our own life. And so we have strict security protocols that people are trained in and that we have to follow. And if we don't, we go home. Because we can't risk ourselves and others trying to be lone wolves or trying to be overly heroic. What we employ are strategic methods of nonviolence that have been shown to protect civilians.
And
we do that, and it works, but we stay within our strategies that are always based upon a conflict analysis and an ongoing context analysis.
And, of course, if you were using violent techniques, there would be at least as good a chance of casualties, injuries, deaths. People get quite upset with nonviolence that someone might get hurt or killed, whereas with violence, it's even more likely, and those lives are just as tragically lost. We're speaking...
So that's a very good point. In the example that I gave with Andreas and Derek, where they stood in the doorway of the tent, both of them said, if we would have been armed, we would have been killed. But
right.
Because we were unarmed, it changed the equation.
Right. This is what people have to understand. We're speaking with Mel Duncan, who is a co-founder of Nonviolence Peace Force. Are there, other than South Sudan, can you list any other parts of the world that you've worked in?
Yes, we currently have a project in Mindanao in the southern Philippines where we have been since 2007. We were an important part of a ceasefire that was implemented in 2009. And for 4 years, we were invited by both the armed forces of the Philippines and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, which was the and is the major rebel group, to oversee the civilian protection component of that ceasefire. Now there is a comprehensive peace agreement that is being implemented, and so we have a team that's there working to help keep things stable as that peace agreement is implemented. We also have a team that is in Myanmar, where we are also working with both the government and the various ethnic groups on a comprehensive ceasefire and on how that is implemented on the ground now as that country goes through a transition to a more civilian-led government. We last fall started a project working with Syrian civil society and are working with a coalition of Syrian groups, some of whom support the government, some of whom oppose the government, and others who are neutral, and working with them on very localized civilian protection and violence deterrence kinds of projects. In addition to that, right now we're raising money to provide protection to those refugees who are caught in Greece, and now if the border into Macedonia has been shut off and it's increasingly hard to move, there's a group of tens of thousands of refugees who are stranded and facing a variety of protection issues. So we're raising money for that, and just this month, We completed an on-the-ground assessment of what we might do in Burundi. So we're looking at those possibilities at this moment.
I'm sure that this work costs a great deal of money, but in comparison with what governments of the world spend on militarism, it has to be dirt cheap. I mean, compared to putting tens of billions of dollars into promoting violence, arming and training proxy armies in places like Syria and Iraq that desperately cry out for this kind of work. What does it cost, and what are governments putting into it? Is the U.S. government funding your work at all?
Well, you're right, first of all, in that war and violence is incredibly expensive. Just this month, the Global Peace Index issued their annual report where they found that in 2015 alone, it cost our world $13.6 trillion in terms of the cost of violence. David, that's 13% of the world economic activity. That works out to almost $1,900 per person for everybody on the planet. That's the cost of violence. And when you look at what we're doing, we're actually the fiscal conservatives, because strategic unarmed approaches to the protection of civilians and to conflict transformation are much less expensive. So, for example, our unarmed civilian protectors, who come from throughout the world, but always at least half of them come from the host country, it costs us about $50,000 on average. That takes care of their room, their board, their transportation, their uniforms, their insurance, and a monthly stipend, because all of our people are paid, because we believe this should be a profession. So for those of us who are listening today, who pay taxes in the United States, we pay about $1 million per soldier in Afghanistan. So think of that, $50,000 compared to $1 million. We are not only effective, but we're a bargain.
But are you getting any U.S. government money at all?
Just recently, got a grant from the State Department for our work in South Sudan. But I hasten to point out that there are a variety of both multi-government organizations and nation states who have been providing us with funding, including the UN High Commission on Refugees, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, the European Union, the governments of Belgium, of the Netherlands, of Norway, United Kingdom, Australia. And so we do get government support. We haven't given up on the U.S. To give more support. In fact, Keith Ellison, who is a representative from Minneapolis and was one of Bernie Sanders' picks for the Democratic Platform Committee, right now has a resolution that he's advocating where one penny on the dollar that goes to the Pentagon would go for unarmed approaches. And that's being advocated as we speak before the Democratic Platform Committee.
Is that it's something he's put into a bill, into legislation introduced in Congress, or just something for the Democratic Party platform?
Right now it's for the platform, but we'll see where that goes.
Well, if it goes somewhere, we should get peace organizations promoting it, because this
is a penny on the dollar, you bet.
We want more than that, but this is a start, and this is a wonderful alternative to war. What about the United Nations? I mean, the United Nations was supposed to be an organization to do away with war.
Yes.
It mostly uses armed forces. It deploys more armed troops around the world than anybody other than the Pentagon. What is the UN's approach to unarmed civilian protection?
Well, you're right that the armed peacekeeping has predominated the UN's approach during their first 70 years to the protection of civilians and the ending of the scourge of war, as you referenced that in the Charter of the UN. We have seen some changes in the past year. There were two major reviews that were conducted, one on UN peace operations, and the second one was on women, peace, and security. Both of those reviews recommended and cited unarmed civilian protection. In fact, the Global Review on UN Peace Operations said unarmed approaches must be at the forefront of UN efforts to protect civilians. And so we're seeing a shift. We are dealing with a huge bureaucracy that is a club of nation states. And remember, nation states, almost all of them are predicated upon violence. And so it is a bit of a task, but we're seeing opening. We're finding that those people at the UN, diplomats, bureaucrats, even the military advisors, who are looking at the immensity of the problem of violence against civilians. Anyone who is paying close attention to that, first of all, is totally overwhelmed, but secondly, we are looking for those effective and efficient ways where civilians can be protected at a scale that meets the need. And that argues for grassroots approaches that can be replicated and scaled up that are nonviolent if we are truly going to address the need of the violence against civilians today.
Do you have hope that the United Nations will move significantly in that direction? Do you have hope that the UN can be reformed? And do you share my view that it's in need of some democratizing reforms?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of the last 4 years working at the UN. And to work there, you either have to be an incrementalist or a masochist. And it helps to be both. And so within that context, yes, there is change. We have seen change. It is in need of major democratic reforms. Now, I don't think that the permanent five members of the Security Council are going to give up their veto. In fact, that's one of the few things right now that unites the United States and Russia, is anytime there's a threat to the veto power, they are arm in arm.
Right.
But there are other reforms that are going on. For example, a reform that's been pushed by member states like Switzerland and Costa Rica and Jordan that would reform the working procedures of the Security Council. And a major reform there would be that in issues that involve atrocity, crime, that the permanent five would voluntarily not use their veto. So they could vote like the other 10 members, but they would not invoke veto power. So that is working its way. That is a General Assembly resolution, which is democratic. All 193 members each have one vote. A couple of other reforms that are significant is right now the UN is going through their process to select a new Secretary General, and is a more transparent process, at least to date. And I think there is a very good chance that the next Secretary General will be a woman, and there's a lot of energy and advocacy for that. Thirdly, there is the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 goals that were passed unanimously by the General Assembly last September that do move us ahead as a planet towards environmental, economic, and peace sustainability. There's a goal specifically on peaceful communities that's one of those 17. And then I think the fourth thing where I find hope is in these global reviews where expert panels from around the world are coming back and advocating very strongly that there has to be a focus on unarmed and nonviolent approaches.
I hope that continues and develops a little less incrementally. We're running out of time with a couple minutes left. Can you tell people how they might get involved, learn more, or help support Nonviolent Peace Force?
Well, first let me say we need everybody. This is a broad, broad effort. People can go to our website, which is nonviolentpeaceforce.org. We consistently recruit for new civilian protectors in the field. This is the hardest work that you'll ever love. And so there are those opportunities. There are also opportunities here in the United States to volunteer. We have local chapters in various parts of the country who do education and support work. We have marvelous interns who work with us year-round and really advance our work. We need support in communication, in organizing events around the country where we will have people come and talk about reasonable alternatives to the military madness that's escalating.
It's a wonderful project. I encourage everyone to support it. We have been speaking with Mel Duncan. He is a co-founder and currently the Director of Advocacy and Outreach for Nonviolent Peace Force. The website, again, is nonviolentpeaceforce.org. Check it out. Get involved. And Mel Duncan will be speaking at our conference in Washington, D.C. in September. Check it out at worldbeyondwar.org, and there will be other events at that time around the country and around the world, and we encourage you to get the resources to start your own, and World Beyond War will help you do that. Mel Duncan, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David, and I look forward to seeing you and working with you in September.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, some might say the recent attacks claimed by ISIS in Baghdad, in Istanbul, and in Medina are proof that the U.S. should invest more in the so-called war on terror. What will it take to turn the conversation away from this idea of bombing our way to peace and safety? We'll hear from Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, author of Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. Also on the show, you may have heard that Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt was the most important Supreme Court ruling on abortion since Roe versus Wade. But what exactly did the court decide, and what could it mean for women not just in Texas, but around the country? Jessica Mason-Piclo, Vice President for Law and the Courts at Rewire, will join us to talk about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Chilcot Report is a 2.6 million word version of the Downing Street memo. That's Dan Frumkin of The Intercept's take on the newly released official inquiry from the UK. That's to say there's not a lot in it that's different from what we learned in 2005, when the minutes of a pre-invasion British cabinet meeting were leaked. Like Chilcot, the so-called Downing Street memo showed that the U.S. had made up its mind that it was going to invade Iraq by 2002, and that, as the head of the British Intelligence Service told British Prime Minister Tony Blair, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. The memo made clear that the UN inspection efforts, though sold to the public as a way to avoid war, were actually conceived in hopes that Iraq would refuse to allow them in and thus generate a pretext for an otherwise illegal invasion. None of this is a shock to the millions of people who marched around the world in hopes of preventing that war, but official confirmation that the rationales were known to be fabrications at the highest levels surely should shape the public conversation. But as FAIR.org contributor Robin Anderson reminds us, the same news outlets that took the official pretenses and ran with them weren't eager to look too closely at those pretenses being popped. Her book, A Century of Media, A Century of War, cites the 2006 New York Times declaring that the Downing Street memo was not shocking since, quote, 3 years ago, the near-unanimous conventional wisdom in Washington held that Mr. Bush was determined to topple Saddam Hussein by any means necessary, close quote. NBC's Andrea Mitchell said you would have to be brain dead not to know what the White House was up to. Except that corporate media weren't telling the story. They later said you'd have to be brain dead not to know. They may think it makes them look savvy, but media's ho-hum justification for not reporting revelations of official deception is a tremendous self-indictment. As Anderson says, quote, admitting to understanding at the time that justifications for war were a ruse, yet not challenging such claims, leaves them not only complicit, but compelling actors in promoting war, close quote. Fareed Zakaria is one of many of the designated serious people in U.S. media who were disastrously wrong about the Iraq war. Let me be honest, I thought that we would have found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq by now, he wrote in a 2003 Newsweek piece headed Why the War Was Right. No matter, the war was still justified as the single best path to reform the Arab world. Well, Zakaria nevertheless has continued being a serious person to take seriously. Most recently, we were asked to ponder his June 30th Washington Post piece, the obvious Trump running mate, Bernie Sanders, of course. He's not being ironic, he's just being silly. Trump and Sanders are largely indistinguishable, it seems, because they're critical of trade deals. That's to say they are, quote, gifted populists who have been able to give voice to people's fears about a fast-changing world, close quote. Yes, this made-you-look hot take is just another platform for Zakaria's free trade proselytizing. Free trade is at the heart of free markets, he actually writes, and he cites some Adam Smith. But the point of it is Sanders with his failed socialism and Trump with his emotional biases are just two sides of the same ignorant coin because they fail to see that trade deals like NAFTA didn't really hurt manufacturing jobs. Quote, manufacturing as a share of all U.S. jobs has been declining for 70 years as part of a transition experienced by every advanced industrial economy. All other developed countries, from Australia to Britain to Germany, which is often seen as a manufacturing powerhouse, have seen similar declines over the past several decades. Close quote. While it's true that as the economy got larger, manufacturing jobs represented a declining share of all employment, but the absolute number of manufacturing jobs held more or less steady from the late 60s through the 90s at about 17 million. Then, in the wake of Bill Clinton's trade deals, the trade deficit exploded and the actual number of those jobs plummeted to about 12.5 million. This did not happen in every advanced industrial economy. It happened in the U.S. because of choices the government made. Zakaria says nothing about how the threat of job loss due to trade serves as a factor in holding down wages. Over the past 50 years, the countries that have grown the most are those that have opened themselves up to global markets, Zakaria says. Also an article of neoliberal faith, also misleading. China, for instance, has had a GDP growth rate of 10.9% annually over the past 50 years, without a particularly open economy. The International Chamber of Commerce places it 59th out of 75 countries in its open market index. And economist Dean Baker would have us note the flaw in Zakaria's premise that what the U.S. has been pursuing is free trade at all. Pacts like the TPP pit manufacturing workers against those in lower wage countries, but they enshrine protections for doctors and dentists, not to mention patent and copyright protections that mean Americans will spend over $430 billion this year for prescription drugs that would cost around a tenth of that in a market that was actually free. Finally, listeners will have heard the stories of two more black people killed by police in just 2 days, Philando Castile in Minnesota and Alton Sterling in Louisiana. This is the lead of the New York Times report on Sterling. Quote, the Justice Department opened a civil rights investigation on Wednesday into the fatal shooting of a black man by the Baton Rouge, Louisiana police after a searing video of the encounter, aired repeatedly on television and social media, reignited contentious issues surrounding police killings of African Americans, close quote. There's much that might be said about the way corporate media approach the reality of racist state violence. I'll just say this. You can't reignite a fire that never stops burning. The myopic suggestion that people are only dying and others only caring when media notice is semantic laziness, but still troubling. But it's really this locution about issues surrounding police killings of African Americans. Police killing of African Americans is the issue, the policies that justify it, and the impunity that follows it. Media vagaries about issues of race and policing, another favorite, obscure the very phenomenon they pretend to address. Without acknowledging that phenomenon, it seems that people are just protesting one police killing, and then another one, and then another one. Until media can name the problem, they're part of it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Early in the morning of Sunday, July 3rd, a truck bomb exploded in a shopping district in Baghdad. Many of the more than 200 people killed were children shopping for new clothes for Eid al-Fitr. The group ISIS claimed responsibility. That was 2 days after militants claiming fealty to ISIS killed 22 people in Dhaka, Bangladesh, after an 11-hour siege on a cafe. It was 5 days after at least 42 people were killed in Istanbul's Ataturk airport. And it was the day before three separate bomb attacks across Saudi Arabia, including one in the holy city of Medina, near a site sacred to Muslims, the mosque where the Prophet Muhammad is believed to be buried. That Americans will have heard more about some of those attacks than others is meaningful, not just because it's always disheartening and distorting to see some victims presented as more human than others. It's especially frustrating when the evident aims of an organization include sowing enmity, division, and resentment. But the U.S. response to ISIS fails on levels even more fundamental than a resistance to acknowledging that Muslims are its primary victims. It has to do with what is meant by fighting ISIS or fighting terrorism to begin with. Joining us now to help us sort through the issues is Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is author of, most recently, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. She joins us by phone from D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
I believe something important was lost when media stopped putting war on terror in quotation marks, when they naturalized it. Because if we think of it as a war, and we know the U.S. has the strongest military in the world by far, then it's impossible to understand, really, why we should feel that this many years into it, we are more vulnerable to terrorist violence than before. How can we make some sense of the current situation with regard to ISIS, where we read that on the one hand, U.S. and Iraqi forces are routing or pushing back on the group, and then the same day's newspaper suggests that attacks by ISIS or its affiliates are increasing?
ISIS has functioned really in two ways militarily. It's functioned as a, I suppose the word is traditional, although I hate to use the term for that, a traditional old-fashioned terrorist organization carrying out bombing attacks, suicide attacks, car bomb attacks, and others on largely civilian populations, mainly in its own region around the Middle East in what it calls its caliphate, and in other countries as well, both in the West, in places like Paris and perhaps San Bernardino, as well as in Bangladesh, maybe, although there's a lot of questions remaining about whether the Bangladesh operation actually had anything to do with ISIS or not. So it's played the role of a terrorist organization with horrific results. It has also, in the creation of the so-called caliphate, played the role of what we might consider a conventional army, seizing and holding territory, taking over populations and ruling them with, in this case, an iron fist. So what we're seeing now is a causal relationship in response to losses on the ground, in this case the loss of the Iraqi city of Ramadi, which was declared, quote, liberated at the end of June by the Iraqi military and its U.S. backers, the U.S. providing the bombs, of course, and the Iraqi Shia militias who fight alongside the Iraqi military. They declared it liberated. They had expelled ISIS from the city. And it was just a few days later that this newest range of bombing attacks began to occur, with the one in Istanbul and then moving to Baghdad, et cetera, as you said, in that bloody set of consequences. That has happened before. The bombing in Paris, for instance, was very soon after the ISIS forces were expelled from the city of Ramadi. And, of course, on the one hand, we hear about the expulsion of ISIS forces as liberation, as a great victory. And certainly it's a good thing when ISIS no longer is in control of hundreds of thousands of people's lives with their terrible violence. But we don't hear very much about what that, quote, liberation actually means. It means, in the case of Ramadi, for instance, that the 350,000 people who once lived there have no city to go back to. 80% of it has been completely demolished, largely by the rounds of U.S. bombing. It's bad enough that in the city of Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, which has been under ISIS control for 2 years now, since 2014, a recent poll just a couple of weeks ago indicated that 76% of the population said, we do not want to be, quote, liberated by these Shia militias that fight with our government's military, because we think they are even more violent and sectarian and dangerous to us. Now, that speaks volumes about what ISIS represents in the eyes of many people in the region, which is a terrible phenomenon, violent, brutal, but maybe not as bad as other forces, some of which are part of or allied with the governments that the U.S. has imposed and armed and pays for. Now, if we take two steps back and look at it more broadly, I think what we see, Janine, is that this set of attacks, whether it was the Istanbul attack, Baghdad, et cetera, all of these are examples, as if we needed any more, of why and how the U.S. policy of military first is failing. because you cannot use military force to wipe out terrorism. You can use military force to get rid of opposition military forces in a city somewhere at enormous cost, as we've seen. But what happens is they then pop up somewhere else doing terrible things to a different population, whether it's in Paris or in San Bernardino or in Baghdad or somewhere else.
I want to interject one thing about media, which is that the phenomenon that you're describing, it's not that it's unknown. Here's the New York Times just a few days ago. As ISIS loses land, it gains ground in overseas terror. You have a source acknowledging that, just as you're describing the trajectories for the state or the caliphate and for these other incidents of violence around the world, they seem to be going in different directions, but in fact, they're not. But what's interesting to me is this sentence, quote, "Combating this evolving, more complex array of threats, attacks loosely inspired by the Islamic State, attacks it directs from afar, and those, as in Baghdad, that it carries out itself, demands more than just military strikes in Iraq and Syria," American officials acknowledge, close quote. This is the problem, this more than, isn't
it? Yeah. This is something that goes back to longstanding positions taken by the Obama administration and by President Obama himself, who has ironically said over and over again, there is no military solution. He's said it in regard to the civil war in Syria. He's said it in regard to ISIS. He says it over and over again, and each time he says it, I want to jump up and cheer. But then he gets to the next sentence, and I sit down again saying, I'm not cheering for this. Because what he says immediately after is, the military part isn't enough. We have to do more. We have to do better diplomacy. We need to do this, this, and this. But the problem is, as long as you're doing the military, the others don't work. You can't be bombing people and at the same time think that you're going to succeed at, quote, persuading them, which is one of the great things the Obama administration has talked about wanting to do, persuading them that ISIS is not their friend. Well, it might be easier to persuade them of that if you weren't killing them. You know, there's something illogical there. So what we need to focus on is that we don't need military and other stuff. We need other stuff instead of the military. We need the high-level attention, the hundreds of billions of dollars, all of the focus of official and unofficial Washington to be focused on non-military reactions, none of which are going to be dramatic, none of which are going to solve the problem overnight. And we should note that the military stuff hasn't worked for 5 years so far. You know, you want to say, well, how's that going for you? But it's the only thing that has any chance in the longer term of working.
Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her most recent book is Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. Find her article, From Paris to Istanbul, More War on Terror Means More Terrorist Attacks, on Foreign Policy in Focus. Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It's always a pleasure.
When a Wire piece headlined, Supreme Court strikes down Texas abortion law, dooms women to substandard care, is bylined Operation Rescue, readers are tipped off as to how genuinely to take the piece's stated concern that by reversing a Fifth Circuit ruling that upheld restrictions Texas placed on abortion providers, the Supreme Court, quote, relegated women to second-class citizens when it comes to abortion by allowing abortionists to evade meeting basic safety standards that are proven to save lives, close quote. Well, Operation Rescue's interest in women's safety is discernible from their involvement in clinic bombings, doctor murders, and screaming, I pray for your death, in the faces of women seeking to terminate a pregnancy for any reason. But what about the line from other abortion opponents like National Right to Life, whose representative in a column for USA Today described the ruling in a case called Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt as a setback that settles nothing? Could that be a bit of hand-waving, too, in the wake of a ruling that actually does appear to have settled a thing or two? We're joined now by Jessica Mason-Piklow. She's Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire, formerly RH Reality Check. She joins us now by phone from Colorado. Welcome to Counterspin, Jessica Mason-Piklow.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Listeners may have heard that Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt is very important, even if they didn't hear too much about it before it came down. On the face of it, it struck down two provisions from a Texas statute, so-called House Bill or HB 2. Before we get to what we think might be the wider repercussions, what were those provisions that were struck down, and what did the court in its majority have to say about them?
HB 2 is what we refer to as an omnibus bill. In this case, HB 2 was an anti-abortion omnibus bill, something I refer to as sort of like the Frankenstein's monster of anti-abortion legislation. And two provisions that were attacked and ultimately struck down involve what we call trap laws or targeted restrictions on abortion providers. And they are increased regulations that are designed to make providing abortions or accessing abortion care extra expensive and extra difficult. So those specific provisions, one requires doctors who perform abortions in the state to have admitting privileges at hospitals nearby. The other required abortion clinics to operate under the same architectural standards as standalone surgical centers. Proponents of those measures had insisted that they were necessary to advance patient safety, that abortion is and was a dangerous medical procedure that justified increased and excessive regulation. And the fact of the matter is the evidence shows exactly the opposite, that these regulations decreased access to care by closing clinics, leaving some places in Texas with as far as 400 to 500 miles and a border checkpoint to get to just access a reproductive health care clinic. And what the Supreme Court said was, no, the evidence is not on your side. And if you are anti-abortion and are a state legislator, you don't get to pass laws that restrict access and pinky swear that they're going to make patient safety better, because they don't.
It seemed very powerful. And folks even noted that the dryness of Stephen Breyer's ruling, it seemed to make the case stronger in the sense that it really said, this isn't about emotions. This isn't about how you feel about things. There are facts that the court can take on board here and that the court has to take on board here.
Well, I mean, I certainly was happy to see that it was Justice Breyer writing the opinion, because he's sort of the data nerd of the court. Court watchers like myself knew that getting an opinion from Breyer was going to be chock full of statistics and comparable analysis, which from an abortion rights standpoint is very, very important, because what we have for the first time, in my opinion, even since Roe, which, you know, was affirming a right to choose as a fundamental right, but not necessarily embracing of the idea that abortion is a fundamental component of a full spectrum of health care. Those are two very different things. And in terms of it being a less emotional opinion, I also think that that is beneficial. But, on the other hand, that kind of bothers me, because we had some real historical moments with this case. For example, for the first time in Supreme Court history, we had a friend of the court brief filed by over 100 women attorneys who themselves had had abortions, telling their abortion stories to the court as to why it mattered. And so while I don't think that law should necessarily be hinged and focused on emotional pleas, I do think it's still kind of troubling that the most significant abortion rights decision that we've gotten, you know, decades, still kind of leaves women voiceless in the opinion.
Right, right. And I had heard that as well. You have to sort of be careful what you're wishing for. But in any way, it does seem like a kind of direct counter to the Fifth Circuit's thinking. And Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times pointed out that they had, in fact, rebuked a district court judge for daring to insist on evidence, you know, for the state's health claims. As a counter to that, I suppose the dryness is preferable.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the Fifth Circuit opinion was just bananas. What they effectively said was the courts have no power, and not only no power, but no constitutional role in double-checking legislatures on certain constitutional matters. And I mean, that's just a failure of fundamental civics. That's just not even like bad judicial opinions. And, you know, Greenhouse is right on the money with her point. You know, one of the other things that the Fifth Circuit decision was really trying to do was give lawmakers a pass to legislate broadly. I mean, this is about abortion rights, most certainly, but think of other areas where conservatives consider the evidence up for debate, right? Like climate change.
Well, you talked about this earlier. This is a response, in a way, to all of these trap laws. It says they actually aren't about women's safety. They're just about stopping abortion, which, of course, I think many of the proponents would have acknowledged, really, that that was what they were about. But that's been the strategy, is to not go after Roe directly, but to kind of make it meaningless by chipping away at access, right? So does this have an immediate impact in other states? I mean, everybody has to litigate it separately, don't they?
Well, yes and no. So we have seen some immediate domino effect. Almost immediately after the court released its decision in Holman v. Health, it turned away two similar cases, one from Wisconsin, where the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals had struck the similar provisions in that state, and then another from Mississippi, where, to your point, lawmakers were very clear that their goal was to regulate out of existence the only abortion provider in the state. Shortly after that, the attorney general from Alabama announced that he was going to drop his state's appeal of an 11th Circuit decision striking their trap laws. And shortly after that, the Center for Reproductive Rights announced a new lawsuit challenging regulations in Louisiana. There'll be, I anticipate, litigation in states like Missouri. So yes, some of these places will need to be litigated step by step. But some of them did fall. So in terms of a sea change, this is a decision that really has the potential to be a big pivot for reproductive rights advocates in terms of the way the court and the law rhetorically considers abortion restrictions.
We've been speaking with Jessica Mason Piclow, Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire. Find them online at rewire.news. Jessica Piclow, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the 1990s, we started talking about global warming. The planet would slowly warm, scientists told us. Maybe that'd be good for people living with cold winters, kind of like Florida slowly moving to your house. Then we learned other things would be affected, like rainfall and rising seas, so we called it climate change. Around 2008, scientist John Holdren said it should be called climate disruption. Meanwhile, Europe has been back and forth between cold and strings of rainy storms. Instead of nice warm winters, the eastern United States has experienced a series of Arctic cold waves and record-setting snowfalls. In 2012, in a paper titled Evidence Linking Arctic Amplification to Extreme Weather in Mid-Latitudes, Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University offered a clear answer, and it was based on observations. The jet stream, that high air current, can drive weather patterns, and now it's slower and wavier due to warming in the Arctic. Her work has generated a little criticism and a lot of support. Now, 3 years later, Dr. Francis is back with co-author Stephen J. Vavris with an update. They say we have entered a new era driven by something called Arctic amplification. With so much at stake, it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Jennifer Francis back to Radio EcoShock. Hello, Dr. Francis.
Hello, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Lots of people want to know what's going on with the weather. I appreciate you joining us. Let's start with the basics. What is Arctic amplification?
Well, it's a term that we give to this phenomenon that the Arctic is more sensitive to global temperature changes than pretty much anywhere else on the planet. And so when the globe warms, the Arctic warms more. And what we're seeing is a rapid warming of the Arctic, while the rest of the Earth is certainly warming, but nowhere near as fast as we're seeing up there.
How can you say we've entered a new era of weather?
I don't know that I can say it's a new era of weather per se, but this idea of Arctic amplification really only started about 10 to 15, maybe 20 years ago when we really started to see the Arctic warm up so fast. And so this is what we think is having a new impact on our weather patterns.
So the Arctic isn't going to get any cooler if we keep dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
You know, it goes up and down every year somewhat, but the general trend is definitely a warming one. And so, you know, some years it warms a lot and some years it doesn't warm quite so much. But the trend is very clear.
I know my East Coast listeners are praying these kinds of vicious winters are not the new normal. Is it possible that they are?
Well, we know that overall, as we continue to increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that we should see a general tendency for record cold events to wane, and we'll see more record warm events. So while we expect this general trend to continue, there is the chance that we'll have these very cold winters like this when the jet stream tends to take up a pattern like it is right now, with a big southward dip right over the eastern half of North America, which allows Arctic air to penetrate farther south than it normally would. But the tendency for these very cold winters probably overall will wane.
So going back to 2012, the main message many of us got from your first paper on this was that the disappearance of sea ice in the Arctic was the driving factor behind weather changes in the fall and winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Your latest work goes well beyond that. Could you explain for us?
Sure. Well, I should first say that, you know, the changes in the Arctic are one factor. There's a lot of changes happening in the climate system simultaneously. And it's one of our challenges is to separate these individual factors and their impacts on weather patterns in mid-latitude. So our hypothesis is that the Arctic is having an effect, but certainly there are other things going on at the same time. So the idea is that because the Arctic is warming so fast, the difference in temperature between the Arctic and areas farther south is getting smaller. And it's that difference in temperature that is really the main fuel driving the jet stream winds. So as that temperature difference gets smaller, the west to east winds of the jet stream are also getting weaker. And this is something that we can measure. We know that when those winds in the jet stream get weaker, the jet stream tends to take a wavier path as it travels around the northern hemisphere. So it tends to wander north and south in bigger swings. And this pattern that we're having this winter, and which looks a whole lot like the pattern last winter, is a very good example of one of these patterns that we're talking about. So there's a huge northward swing over the western part of North America and a big southward dip over the east. And this has huge impacts on the weather that we experience down here on the surface. So as you know, out west they're having terrible drought and heat waves, while in the east it's just the opposite. We're going through a winter of record-breaking cold, and along the east coast it's been extremely stormy with snowstorm after snowstorm piling up the snow along the east coast. So what our latest work has shown is that we're actually able to measure an increased frequency of these types of patterns, and this type of pattern being when the jet stream gets into one of these very wavy configurations with a big northward swing and a big southward swing. And we're seeing this happen particularly over North America and the Atlantic. It seems to be sort of the hot spot for these very wavy patterns to set up. So that was one of the new results that came out of our recent research.
So as you say, we know planet Earth came with some big cycles and natural variability even before humans changed the atmosphere. And one of them is very important to weather in the north, and that's the alternation in pressure zones called the Arctic Oscillation or the Northern Annular Mode. Please tell us what that is and then how it relates to your work on the jet stream.
Right. So you can think of the Arctic Oscillation and whether it's positive or negative as being an indicator of the strength of the jet stream. When the Arctic Oscillation is in its so-called positive mode, the jet stream tends to be very strong. It means that that pressure difference between the Arctic and the areas farther south is large. So when we have that positive mode and the jet stream is strong, it tends to travel quite straight in a sort of straight circle around the northern hemisphere. We don't have these really big waves that I was just describing. And when it's in its negative mode, the opposite phase, is when we tend to see these very wavy patterns in the jet stream. And so it's linked to this idea that we're talking about, and there has been a tendency in the last several years for this Arctic oscillation to tend towards a more negative phase. So this is the phase where it tends to be very wavy. The jet stream tends to be very wavy.
Is the Arctic oscillation alone enough to explain the strange things we're seeing with the jet stream?
No, I don't think it is, because the Arctic Oscillation is an average index for the whole northern hemisphere. And what we tend to see is a wavy pattern setting up in one area and maybe not so much somewhere else. And it tends to vary in where these wavy patterns set up from one year to another. In fact, this winter is a great example because the Arctic Oscillation has actually been in a fairly positive mode most of the winter, yet in North America and in the eastern Pacific and in the Atlantic, we've had an extremely wavy pattern to the jet stream. So the Arctic Oscillation is an indicator, but it's often not very good in terms of particular locations.
And what about the impact of warming oceans, including the record high temperatures right along New England, where so many snowy storms hit this past winter?
Right. Well, there's a couple of sides to that story. We have very warm waters off of the Pacific coast, and they're also very warm off the Atlantic. And there are two impacts of those warm waters. As you said, along the East Coast, the warm waters are contributing to our very stormy winter and our very heavy snowfalls. When that water is extra warm off our coast, it does a couple of things. It increases the temperature difference between the land and the ocean, and that temperature difference is a source of energy for storms. And also, when the water's warm, we tend to get more evaporation, which provides more moisture for those storms. So we have the possibility of having heavier snowstorms, for example, in the winter, or heavier downpours if it happens to be a rain event. So that's what's contributing to our very stormy winter along the East Coast. But out in the West, and the very warm waters that are in place right now off of the Pacific coast, we think are contributing to this very wavy pattern, in fact. And that northward swing in the jet stream I mentioned out west is probably being fueled partially by this very warm water that's sitting off the west coast.
Another challenge for research has been the different patterns in different seasons. The last time I talked with you a couple of years ago, you seemed fairly sure about what was happening in the fall and winter, but less sure about the spring and summer. Is this Arctic change affecting all four seasons now?
Well, we think it is. And since we talked a couple of years ago, there's been a lot of research been done by a bunch of different groups around the world looking at this linkage between Arctic change and weather patterns in mid-latitudes. And what we've learned is that the mechanisms that are creating the linkages vary with season and with location. So there isn't sort of one story we can tell that explains this linkage. A group in Germany, for example, has been looking at connections between ice loss in the Arctic and summer extreme weather patterns over Europe and Asia, and finding that the loss of sea ice in the summertime is contributing to these sorts of extreme events because that warming in the Arctic is causing the jet stream to split. Sometimes in the summer, it's more likely to do that when there's less sea ice. And when the jet stream splits, it tends to trap these waves in the jet stream, and they tend to stay in one place. And that leads to some of the extreme events that are related to very persistent weather patterns, like heat waves and drought and flooding. So that's, you know, one of these mechanisms that have been studied that is just a summer mechanism. There are others that people have been identifying that occur only in the wintertime. One of these that appears to be very robust is a link to ice loss over Western Russia in the Arctic area just north of Western Russia, and that seems to be causing the tendency for very cold winters over Central Asia. So a lot of people are looking at these various aspects of the linkage, and we're learning a lot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University in New Jersey. We're talking about her work showing the jet stream has been changed by warming in the Arctic and how that leads to differences in weather in the Northern Hemisphere. So, Dr. Francis, not everyone agrees with your work. In December, I interviewed Dr. Kevin Trenberth of the Snow and Ice Data Center. He hesitated to agree with your findings and suggested things like Tropical Storm Nuri hitting Alaska are also important factors. There was even a paper out from Elizabeth Barnes of Colorado State University contradicting your findings. How do you respond to these critics?
Well, I'm the first to admit, as I said in the very beginning, that the Arctic warming is not the only factor that's changing in the climate system. And our challenge, or one of our challenges, is to sort out how these different changes in the climate system are affecting mid-latitude weather patterns. So I agree with Kevin Trenberth that, yes, indeed, hurricane or tropical storm Nuri had a big impact on the jet stream. We know that when tropical systems interact with the jet stream, they can have a big impact. And, you know, we've seen that going back in time, and we'll see it going forward into the future. But that doesn't mean that the Arctic isn't also playing a role. And in fact, there was a new paper that came out just this week by a group in Korea showing how the very extreme pattern last winter that looks very much like the pattern that we're experiencing right now with this big northward swing in the jet stream over the west and the big dip over the east was caused by a combination of sea surface temperature patterns in the Pacific and sea ice loss in the Arctic. So the sea surface temperatures in the Pacific tend to favor this kind of pattern, but because we've lost so much sea ice, the pattern has been intensified. So, you know, I agree that the tropics are also very important, but we're also seeing this maybe amplifying effect due to the Arctic. And I just wanted to make one correction to your statement relative to Elizabeth Barnes's work. Her research did not contradict our research. It just pointed out the fact that it's very difficult to extricate one factor from this very noisy climate system that we're dealing with. So she was not able to come up with a statistically robust repetition of our work, but it's not like she came out and said, you know, we're wrong, and I find something completely different.
All right. Now, leading to that, how well can climate models predict what we actually observe in these things that we're talking about?
Well, that's actually another challenge that we're facing. The climate models seem to have a problem with simulating these very wavy jet stream patterns. And in particular, there's a phenomenon called a blocking high. And that's when the jet stream takes such a big northward swing that it actually breaks off into a separate eddy, if you will, just like an eddy in a river. And when those happen, the weather patterns on either side of those blocking patterns get stuck in place for a long time. And we think that some climate models do a better job of simulating these than others. We're still looking into why some of them are able to create them and some don't do them very well. So that's one of the questions that we're dealing with.
And what does your study predict will happen for both the jet stream and for weather in the Northern Hemisphere if we continue to operate a civilization based on dumping excess carbon into the atmosphere?
Well, I think I'd have to say that we'll see a continuation of these wavy jet stream patterns because we expect the Arctic to continue to warm much faster than areas to the south. Perhaps we'll see kind of a leveling off in the fall as we go towards an Arctic summer system with no sea ice at all in it. But I think we'll see an increase in these very wavy patterns in the other seasons as we continue to lose sea ice in the other seasons as well. So we've seen this Arctic amplification being strongest in the fall and the winter so far, but it's also increasing in the spring and the summer. So those seasons we should start to see a stronger response of the jet stream.
I got a little confused by a couple of points in your paper's conclusion and discussion. First of all, you write, while weaker zonal winds have been observed in response to reduced poleward temperature gradients, the link to a wavier upper-level flow has not yet been confirmed. And I thought your paper really was confirming that. How does this change in lower-level winds actually change the high-level jet stream?
Right. So this is kind of a comment to reviewers of our paper saying that, you know, you can't make a strong statement yet about how the waviness of the jet stream is responding to a rapidly warming Arctic. I actually agree with you. I think that we provided some pretty convincing evidence that when we see these areas of rapid warming in the Arctic, that we at the same time see the winds in the upper levels becoming more wavy. But, you know, not everybody agrees with us yet, and we still have to provide more evidence of this phenomenon happening in the real world.
Right about now, Jennifer Francis, some listeners in New England are thinking about a move to the West Coast. That sounds really good. Should they do it?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think life on the East Coast is wonderful, and I think maybe they should just take up a winter sports that they enjoy. You know, if you really can't stand the cold, then you probably shouldn't be living in the East anyway, because that's just the way winters are in the East Coast. But that said, I think going forward, what we'll probably see are plenty of cold winters, but, you know, you don't have to look back very far in time to see a very warm winter. In fact, the winter of 2012, people forget when they're in a situation like we're experiencing this winter that only a couple of years ago, we broke thousands, like literally over 3,000 high temperature records in the winter of 2012. So I think my message would be get ready for weirdness, not necessarily one type of winter versus another. You know, some winters they're going to be like the one we're experiencing now, but, you know, maybe next year we'll have just the opposite.
What can our listeners in Europe and Russia take from your research?
They're experiencing their own very unusual conditions. Just this winter and the winter before, the UK, I think you mentioned in your introduction, has been experiencing a very stormy winter. They set all-time records for precipitation last winter, and those records go back to over 250 years in parts of the UK. But at the same time, you'll remember the Sochi Olympics were having a hard time keeping snow on the ski slopes for the ski events. And this winter as well, they're having a very warm pattern in much of Scandinavia and that part of Europe. So they, too, are having some very unusual conditions that tend to be very persistent. And that's really the bottom line of what our research is suggesting, is that we should be seeing weather patterns that are more persistent. And that goes along with these very wavy jet stream situations. We know that when the waves get very large in the jet stream, they tend to not move very quickly. And because those waves create the weather that we experience, the conclusion is that we should start to see, and we are seeing, more persistent weather patterns.
Well, as we wrap up, your name is becoming associated with the science behind some rotten changes in weather. The TV weather people don't explain the causes of this exciting weather porn, but when they do mention it, I've heard your name. Did it surprise you to acquire this public role?
Yes, it did. I certainly didn't see it coming. Looking back, I can understand why people might be very interested in all this, because there's a couple reasons. First of all, they're noticing that the weather that they're experiencing in their own regions is behaving very weirdly now. And we have data to back that up. There are more extreme events now in terms of weather than there used to be. And the other thing is, it's something that we're connecting to the Arctic, and the Arctic is somewhere that people can look and see climate change happening before their very eyes. They can see maps of sea ice extent, for example, and notice that half of it's gone just compared to 30 years ago. So they're able to make this link in their own minds between a very obvious change in the climate system up in the Arctic and relate that. We're providing a way to relate that to what's happening in their own backyards, in their own personal experience. And so, you know, it's got people talking. I think people are realizing that climate change is not going to be this gradual warming that'll happen to their grandchildren. It's something that's happening today, and we have an explanation for why that might be.
We've been talking with Dr. Jennifer Francis. She's a research scientist with the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Her new paper, Evidence for a Wavier Jet Stream in Response to Rapid Arctic Warming, was published in the journal Environmental Research Letters in January of 2015. Find links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Dr. Francis, thank you so much for taking time to explain your work.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Let's look deeper into a few issues raised in this interview with Jennifer Francis. First of all, why does this new paper say we are in a new era of Arctic amplification, or AA? We have reliable temperature and other weather readings from the Arctic starting in 1940. According to this paper, starting in the 1990s, in the same time frame as the sea ice declined, Arctic amplification could be seen in all four seasons for the first time. It hadn't been seen in records when they were started in 1940 and on to 1990. So that's one sign of a new era. Going further, the paper says, quote, "It is important to note the recent emergence of the signal of Arctic amplification from the noise of natural variability. Since about 1995 near the surface, and since the year 2000 in the lower troposphere. This short period represents a substantial challenge to the detection of robust signals of atmospheric response amid the noise of natural variability. Thus, for this study, we define the period from 1995 to 2013 as the Arctic amplification era." So, we've entered a new era, courtesy of what's happening up there in the far north. You'll notice I spent a little time with Dr. Francis on the natural cycle called the Arctic Oscillation, and sometimes called the Northern Annular Mode. We'll stick with Arctic Oscillation, or AO. So pay attention to this statement by Dr. James Hansen of NASA, which exactly explains this past winter. He says, "When the AO index is negative, there tends to be high pressure in the polar region, weaker zonal winds, and greater movement of frigid polar air into the middle latitudes." That's from Hansen's 2009 paper called "If It's That Warm, How Come It's So Damn Cold?" And it's too bad climate denier Senator James Inhofe is too dumb to understand it. Now, I specifically asked Jennifer Francis about the Arctic Oscillation because if that's all it is, the awful weather pattern in the U.S. Northeast will just go away when the Arctic Oscillation goes positive. Francis has three answers, really. First, the Arctic Oscillation is not a final indicator of getting a disturbed jet stream and a polar vortex in North America. This past winter had a positive AO and still got hit with polar weather further south. Secondly, we can see that the pole is warming, with ice melting, permafrost thawing, and a much warmer winter in Alaska, for example, because of climate change. Finally, though, the super cold winters in eastern North America will get less frequent over time, she tells us, because we're warming the whole planet. I did a Radio EcoShock show titled Summer in March back in 2012 because that winter was so frequently warm. People were playing tennis in New York City parks in January that year. Parents in Quebec couldn't get the traditional outdoor skating rinks to freeze. The unpleasant answer is we have caused climate disruption. Expect the unexpected, good and bad.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I want to move on to talk about the IPCC and something called the RPC. I'll explain. Evidence is growing that the Paris climate talks at the end of 2015 are an exercise in futility. A couple of Radio EcoShock listeners alerted me to this dangerous charade. It's explained best by the UK filmmaker and climate blogger Nick Breeze at Envisionation. Here's the audio segment from Nick's latest film, Warning.
In the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fifth assessment report, as IPCC AR5, there have been published a selection of Representative Concentration Pathways, or RCPs. Dr. Matt Watson from the School of Earth Sciences at the University of Bristol in the UK made this point strongly at a recent meeting at the Royal Society in London.
This is why this is the latest projections from the International Panel of Climate Change. And the alarming thing, which again Sir Brian highlighted, is that these two scenarios actually explicitly include negative emissions technologies. So there is geoengineering of the flavour of carbon dioxide removal in the best case scenarios. The very, very alarming thing for us is that we are on this path here. That's AR 8.5. We are slap bang on this trajectory, and that puts us in a very, very different place in our children's or our grandchildren's lifetimes.
Of the scenarios projected into the future, only two appear to be able to keep us close to a 2-degree rise of temperature. As Dr. Watson mentioned just now, these are called respectively RCP 2.6 and RCP 4.5. This chart is intended to give an idea of what concentrations of greenhouse gases take us to what temperatures, with 2 degrees Celsius being the consensus limit for safety. The amber and the black coloured lines are from historical records, and the red, green and blue are forecasts. As Watson alluded to, the RCP we are currently on is the red one titled RCP 8.5. This is not a survivable path. The RCPs from 4.5 to 8.5 will cause us to lose our tree sink and the ice sheets. Without the trees, we will be inundated with greenhouse gases, and humanity simply will not be able to survive. This leaves RCP 2.6, which has an estimated temperature range of 0.9 to 2.3 degrees Celsius. We are already very close to the 0.9 degree scenario, so our chances of staying within the range of temperature are very slim, especially when you consider that emissions are still estimated to increase. Former President of the Royal Society, Professor Martin Rees, made this statement during our interview.
I think we all hope that emission reductions will be achieved, but the lack of success of current attempts at international agreements encourages pessimism. And I honestly would bet, sad though it is, that the annual CO2 emissions are going to rise year by year for at least the next 20 years, and that'll build up a cumulative level close to 500 parts per million by then.
Based on what we know, it is fair to say that the Earth's sensitivity to greenhouse gas emissions mean that we will experience a great deal more heating yet, with an added boost from feedback such as methane releases and tree loss. However, there is another fly in the ointment regarding nearly all of the representative concentration pathways. As Dr. Watson said, they actually factor in a geoengineering solution called carbon dioxide removal, or CDR, whereby billions of tons of carbon are actually removed from the atmosphere and stored somewhere on Earth, either as some form of biochar or perhaps as living matter called biomass. But as is widely known, no such technology actually exists, and the research into developing it has been riddled with controversy, conspiracy, governmental inaction, misrepresentation, and a whole host of other inhibitors. The bottom line is that we are basing our collective future safety on this planet on pure science fiction.
If we want to sequester CO2 and make a difference, we have to sequester something which is a significant fraction of 35 billion tons per year. So what's a significant fraction of 35 billion? Let's say 20 billion tons. 10 billion tons even, let's make a start. 10 billion tons a year of carbon sequestration. We don't do anything on this planet on that scale. We don't manufacture food on that scale. We don't mine iron ore on that scale. We don't even produce oil, coal or gas on that scale. Iron ore is below a billion tons a year. How are we going to invent a technology from scratch, highly complicated technology, to the tune of 10 billion tons a year?
Deputy Director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, Professor Kevin Anderson, said this in a recent interview.
It's also really important to note that we are already, when we are developing our emission scenarios, our ways of thinking about the future, virtually every single emission scenario that is aimed at meeting our climate change obligations that we sign up to internationally, so this idea of keeping the rising global average temperature to below 2 degrees C, virtually every single emission scenario that we've so far generated on that includes geoengineering. It assumes it automatically works. Now, that's fine if one or two of the scenarios had that, but almost every single scenario has it. So already what we're finding is that geoengineering, even though it's still in a very experimental conceptual stage, that we are assuming it will work and we are embedding it in our scenarios, and from those are what we go on to advise policymakers from. So it is already having a really very pernicious effect in trying to in influencing what it is policymakers, what it is civil society, what it is that companies and other people who are not directly involved in the science understand about climate change. And if you talk to most of the policymakers, they're not aware that actually already in all of the advice they're getting from scientists, there's an assumption that we'll be able to suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere in the future. That is already occurring today.
We have a very real and very serious crisis on our hands. We cannot allow emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases to keep rising. We have to reverse the trend, and fast. We are currently at the dangerous level of 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide and rising. In the pre-industrial era, we were around 280 parts per million. To be safe, we should be aiming to reduce the concentration to beneath 320 parts per million. This means developing a means of removing billions of tons of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. We should be very concerned that the IPCC have included the use of geoengineering technology in their future emission scenario, and that the actual technology does not currently exist and is not even being adequately researched or funded.
That was audio from a new short film by Nick Breeze titled Survivable IPCC Projections Are Based on Science Fiction. You can find it at envisionation.co.uk, so that's envisionation.co.uk, or use the link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Nick does some great interviews, often with prominent climate scientists. It pays to keep visiting his site. So, the Paris Climate Talks are already a sellout of humanity and all species, even if they are a so-called success, which is doubtful. I'd say the best climate activists can do at this point is to push their country governments to do far more and to include a new vision of naturally capturing carbon back into the soil. As we've heard from recent Radio EcoShock guests like Thomas Goreau and Kristen Olson, we can lower the burden of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere by changing the way we do agriculture. That will need a parallel shift in our whole economy and lifestyles, yes, but it can work. Unlike the fairy tale tech of carbon capture and storage, we know how to put large amounts of carbon back into the soil. So far, the climate talks do not even include the soil carbon option. Let's try and change that before it's really, really too late. Get soil carbon into the Paris Climate Talks. Pass the word.
Radio EcoShock.
Humans are changing the planet in many ways, but we are not alone out there. There are diseases looking for new conquests and parasites being spread around the world by air travel, shipping, and resource extraction. Experts warn we are already in a crisis of emerging infectious disease, or EID. We have one of those experts with us now. Dr. Daniel Brooks was a longtime zoology professor at the University of Toronto. Now he's a senior research fellow with the Mantor Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska. Dr. Brooks is also a visiting scholar in Brazil and Hungary. His latest paper was published February 15, 2015, in the journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. It warns climate change will bring us new and dangerous guests. Dr. Brooks, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
What are the signs that a crisis of spreading diseases is upon us?
Well, what I would have to say is that what we hear about in the mass media, that is, these emerging diseases that are affecting human beings, is only the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones that affect human health most immediately, and so they get most of the attention. But the same kind of dynamic that is at work that occasionally produces new diseases directly in human beings is happening more broadly all over the globe, and it's affecting all species of plants and animals, including all of those that human beings rely on for their own socioeconomic maintenance and their own standard of living and their own survival. So what we're talking about is emerging diseases, not just in humans, but also in crops and livestock and even wildlife that humans, at least some human beings, depend on for their livelihood.
Well, just to get one thing out of the way, getting back to humans, do you expect our species to be decimated by a super disease?
No, absolutely not. In fact, our perspective is, in a way, it's kind of the opposite of the Andromeda strain. What we expect to happen, we expect to see a lot of fairly localized disease outbreaks, none of which really have the possibility of doing severe damage on a global scale to humanity. But every one of these outbreaks does cost something. It does exact some sort of cost on human resources. And so our concern about climate change and emerging diseases and the future of humanity has more to do with the possibility that because we're not anticipating having lots of emerging diseases, we're not prepared for them. We only respond to them after they happen, and we hope that each one is the last one. But if we're correct, there are going to be many, many of these, and if we don't begin to anticipate that they're going to happen, then we won't be able to adopt measures for mitigating their effects. And eventually, rather than, you know, one Andromeda strain that kills all of humanity, what we end up with is something that Eric Hoberg and I have called death by a thousand cuts. So lots and lots and lots of little diseases, each one of which has a particular cost. And eventually there's so many of them that they overwhelm the healthcare and veterinary care delivery services.
Let's back up a little bit. Is there a difference between diseases and parasites?
Well, there's a difference. Yes, in a sense. Disease, many, many organisms are capable of creating a disease syndrome in an organism. So, for example, some viruses cause disease and some don't. But in addition to that, some people who are infected with some viruses or some bacteria are diseased, and some are infected but not diseased. So a good example of that would be Streptococcus bacteria. Every human being has a colony of Streptococcus bacteria living in their throats. But at any one time, very few human beings have what we call a strep throat. That is, very few human beings actually are in a disease situation with respect to their relationship with the Streptococcus. Streptococcus is always potentially capable of producing disease, but in that particular case, usually a strep throat is associated with the Streptococcus plus the human being plus something else, like the human being being stressed out or very tired or worn down for some reason. And so what we have is the potential for disease is there in a lot of organisms. And in the case of emerging diseases, there's a much higher probability that disease will happen because in emerging diseases, you have pathogenic organisms or parasites that are moving into hosts that are susceptible, but they've never been exposed before, which means they've never had the opportunity to develop resistance.
So your new paper, co-authored with Eric Hoberg of the USDA Research Service, you found a disturbing trend. Scientists previously counted on parasites and diseases becoming ever more adapted to their hosts and so limited to just them. Can you first describe that process and then what you found could happen instead?
Right. Well, yes, that particular process, the idea is that there's a trade-off between how well adapted a particular parasite or pathogen is to a particular host and the ability to survive another host. So the idea is that the more, you know, in a sort of a metaphorical sense, the more time and effort you put into one relationship, the less likely it is you'll be able to establish another relationship. And if that's true, then that's the way Eric and I were trained as graduate students as well. If that's true, then one of the things that should be true is that we should see very few parasites or other pathogens jumping from one host to another. And yet we see that all the time. And in the last 30 years, Eric and I, in my work in the tropics and his work in the Arctic, both of us have seen this happening a lot in real time. And so we wondered what this was about because it was different from what we'd been taught. We then both did a series of deep evolutionary analyses. And what we discovered was that in the evolutionary past, the last ice age, 15 million years ago, even as long as 65 million years ago, what we find is that these emerging diseases, that is, pathogens jumping to new hosts, there are bursts of them in evolutionary history. And each one of those bursts is highly correlated with a period of time when there was a massive climate change event. And so what we began to realize, or we believe what is happening, is that the climate change drives all kinds of species to move around. They change their geographic distributions. And human beings are accelerating that because we move ourselves and we move crops and livestock all over the world as well. And that just accelerates that general process of species moving around and moving around. And the more species move around, the more likely it is that they're going to come into contact with a pathogen that they're susceptible to, but they've never seen before. And that pathogen is going to jump immediately into that new host. But because there's no resistance, the association between that pathogen and its new host will be a disease relationship.
And you also brought out the intriguing idea that they could revert to what you called ancestral genetic capabilities.
Well, they don't revert to it. They retain it, okay? Now, most people, most non-biologists, don't really understand that most of the characteristics, say, that human beings have are persistent ancestral characteristics. These are characteristics that evolved long before human beings did. For example, every cell in your body has its DNA inside a membrane, something called a nucleus. And cells with a nucleus like that evolved about 1.5 billion years ago. And the fact that we have that kind of cell structure is a persistent ancestral legacy of 1.5 billion years ago. So what happens with all organisms is that they have many more capabilities than they show at any one time. And a lot of those capabilities are based on their ancestry. So we know, for example, that let's say you've got a chimpanzee living in an area where there are other primates. There's a high likelihood that the chimpanzee might pick up parasites from the other primate, or the other primates might pick up parasites from chimpanzees because they're very similar, because they're closely related, and they have a lot of ancestral similarities in common. And the parasites oftentimes can be very, very specialized on a characteristic that one host has, but there may be other hosts that share that exact same characteristic because of common ancestry. And that means that those other hosts are sitting in some other part of the world. And if the parasite ever gets to them, the parasite's going to think it's just more of the same kind of host material, and it will jump immediately into the new host.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Daniel Brooks about climate change and the spread of diseases and parasites. You know, Dr. Brooks, West Nile virus scared the pants off many people when it first arrived in North America. And as a Canadian, we can hardly avoid being bitten by mosquitoes, you know. But we haven't seen many deaths from it. Why not?
Well, Okay, West Nile virus actually, it wasn't the West Nile virus introduction to North America is actually a really good example of what we're talking about. When it was first introduced to North America, no one should have been surprised, number one, that it could be introduced successfully because there are songbirds in North America and there are human beings in North America. And in Africa and in Russia, where West Nile virus shows up all the time, it's in humans and it's in songbirds. So the fact that there are humans and songbirds in North America means that if West Nile ever got to North America, there's a high probability that it was going to become established. And it did become established. And the first thing that happened was that it spread into populations of human beings that had never seen it before and populations of songbirds and species of songbirds that had never been exposed to West Nile virus before. And the first thing that happened was massive acute disease outbreak. Lots of birds died, a fair number of human beings died, a lot got sick. But now, a decade later, or whatever it is, the songbird populations have recovered, and very few birds and very few humans are actually getting sick each year or dying from West Nile virus. However, West Nile virus is still here, and it's never going to go away. And so that means that there's always going to be the potential for a new outbreak in the future. This is what we're worried about in terms of the socioeconomic implications, that each one of these, see, we could say right now West Nile virus is not costing society very much, but it's costing something. And each one of these diseases that comes in is going to cost something. And eventually, there's going to be a huge impact in terms of the economics of trying to deal with a whole bunch of these emerging diseases, even though each one of them may be relatively minor by itself.
Does the scientific community have predictions of what can happen with diseases and parasites, say, by 2050 or by 2100, if the world stays on its current carbon-burning path?
The short answer is yes, there are lots of predictions. But a slightly longer answer is that Eric and I believe that those projections grossly underestimate what's going to happen because they're based on the assumption that emerging diseases are going to be relatively rare, that parasites don't jump hosts. So the idea is that, well, yes, climate change may move species around with their pathogens, but the assumption is that those pathogens will stay with the original host. And what we're saying is, no, things are going to jump around a lot. And that means that whatever projections we have right now, I mean, Eric and I would say, and parenthetically, we'd love to be wrong. But if we're correct, then the projection should be that there are going to be a lot of emerging diseases, and a lot of them are going to be in crops and livestock and wildlife that are not infecting human beings, but they are causing economic hardship to human beings by affecting our food supply and affecting the livelihoods of people in agriculture.
And you don't present this emerging crisis as just a medical issue. What is it really if it's not just medical?
Well, it's a socioeconomic crisis. I mean, basically what we're looking at is the possibility of disruptions in food, disruptions in jobs associated with food production, and therefore indirect effects on human beings. You know, working in the tropics and developing countries, I've worked in many places where if the local pigs, for example, became infected with some novel parasite and most of them died, a lot of people in a remote village might die as well. They would have nothing to eat. They would have no way to sustain themselves. And if the emerging disease crisis is correlated with climate change and biodiversity, we have to remember that the vast majority of the world's biodiversity occurs in places where the vast majority of the world's poor people live. And on top of that, if our scenario is correct and it's movements of people and animals around the planet that are associated with moving pathogens around and creating the opportunities for pathogens to jump into new hosts, then things like refugee human beings displaced by warfare are going to be a not insignificant contributor to moving diseases around the planet. So all of this, the medical part of it turns out to be a critical element, but not the big picture. It's embedded in the larger picture.
Well, now, just to take the bleak view, if we are entering a sixth great mass extinction, in part due to climate change, how are these pests at surviving such climate changes?
Oh, that's a great, great question. And this is one of the most fundamentally important pieces of research in this whole area. It was something that was done by Eric Hoberg. And Eric was working in the Arctic, working on seabirds in a family called the Alcidae, puffins and murrelets and things like that, these beautiful marine birds. And Eric found that these birds are inhabited by or infected by groups of parasites that are much, much older than the birds themselves. So that group of birds as a group, an evolutionary group, let's say, is 35 million years old. But the parasites, we can do this genetic dating of the parasites and the host, we find that the parasites are nearly 100 million years old. And so it appears that these parasites were originally in marine dinosaur-like things, plesiosaurs and mosasaurs and things like that, these great big marine reptiles, all of which went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous period that's associated with the massive asteroid strike on Earth. And all of those original hosts went extinct, but the parasites didn't. The parasites went right through that mass extinction event and simply changed hosts. And so now we have 100 million-year-old parasites living in 35 million-year-old birds. So it looks like one of the things about these parasites and pathogens is that they are extraordinarily good survivors. And we can't count on a mass extinction event to wipe out a lot of pathogens. Maybe the exact opposite.
Oh, boy. Well, now, on the front line, we have veterinarians. They often discover sick animals, whether they're on the farms or as pets. Do the vets have a good pathway to stay tuned to what disease experts know if things evolve rapidly?
That's also an excellent question. The short answer is we don't have a good general mechanism for that, not in North America, much less in developing parts of the world. That's one of the things that Eric and I suggest is what we need to be doing is we need more and more basic scientists, natural history people and ecologists and taxonomists in museums actually working to provide much more detailed information about what is out there that could potentially show up in your cattle or your horses or eating your apple trees. And we don't, at the moment, you're right, we don't have a good network and a good means of communication for that. The main reason we don't have that is because we don't have money and we don't have governmental policy. Those two things are tied together. In the United States, for example, as soon as the American government decides to stop being stupid and admit that climate change is real, then it's possible to have actual public policies based on we need to adapt to climate change. Once that happens, then it's possible to obtain new research money to actually do something about implementing policies to adapt to change. But until there's a political will, the scientists are basically, like me, are just basically sitting here twiddling our thumbs and saying, you know, if you ever need us, we're here. we're ready. It's like sometimes I tell people, don't be afraid, we have a plan. But at the moment, nobody wants to hear the plan. Nobody that can say yes to major public policy wants to hear about that plan yet.
Not until it costs us enough money that Wall Street notices it on the balance books, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what we're afraid of, is that we will wait until, you know, the crisis is overwhelming us before we decide to do something.
So we have had a very good run here in the West. We're conquering or almost conquering many diseases of the ages. How confident should we be that this will just continue?
What will continue?
Well, it's almost like we have a magic shield that we think that vaccines and the medicines will protect us. So whatever new diseases or pests show up, we'll handle it.
Well, I would say that our biggest cause for concern is that the world's largest experiments in natural selection have been all of these massive global experiments that the pharmaceutical industry has been doing in trying to provoke the emergence of antibiotic pathogens. And it works every time. Natural selection works all the time. And the pharmaceutical industry is able to produce these antibiotic resistant strains all the time, which of course gives them a reason to charge more money to develop yet more drugs to try to get ahead of the next one and the next one and the next one. And the reality is that we're not winning this. This is not a golden age.
That's a shocker. All right, listeners, the article by our guest, who is a longtime Canadian professor, Daniel Brooks, and Eric Hoberg from the USDA, is titled Evolution in Action, Climate Change, Biodiversity Dynamics, and Emerging Infectious Disease. It's part of a special issue on climate change and vector-borne diseases of humans, and that's in the journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B. Daniel Brooks is currently a senior research scientist with the Mantar Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise, as scary as it might be sometimes.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This interview with Daniel Brooks has a couple of key thoughts. First, while humans mentally long for a single threat where we can focus, the natural world is too complex to accommodate that need. Unlike the movie The Andromeda Strain, the experts don't think we will run into a single giant disease or parasite to knock off our species. AIDS, Ebola, and West Nile virus arrive and manage to stay around but don't do us in. By the way, if I sounded disappointed in the West Nile virus after the initial hype, here's some news. The extra warm, dry conditions in California brought the highest level of West Nile virus ever seen in that state. There were 798 human cases in 2014, five times the number recorded in 2011 at the start of this big drought. 29 people died last year. You might think drier weather means less mosquito-borne diseases like West Nile virus, but streams and even rivers that normally keep running enough to keep clear of mosquito larvae end up with more stagnant pools to breed. Plus, with fewer water sources, more species come to those that are left, meaning a better transfer station for diseases to all kinds of species. The Sacramento YOLO Mosquito Control is warning Californians to expect, quote, an intense West Nile virus year. It's just another unexpected spin-off of climate change and the very thing Dr. Brooks warned us about. Meanwhile, the news is full of more examples of how climate change will influence the appearance of new diseases and pests. Just this past week, a new study from Oslo, Norway, rewrote the history books of how the Black Plague hit Europe in the 1300s and kept coming back for hundreds of years afterwards. According to the book Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, about 90% of the people in the Hopi province of China died from the plague in 1331. 90%. 15 years later, the disease made it to the Volga River in Russia. The Mongol Empire partly ended because their Pony Express system, which likely spread the disease, couldn't find enough riders left alive. Scientists now think that periods of warmer and wetter weather in Asia stimulated the populations of plague-carrying ticks, and these were mostly carried by gerbils, not the black rat. The gerbils likely spread the plague to pack animals. Evidence seems to show that the plague did not stay resident in Europe's rats, as we thought, but instead kept arriving from Asia following warm weather spells there. Rats carrying the plague were themselves killed off, rather than harboring the horrible disease. Europe was reinfected dozens of times, hundreds of times. Investigating over 7,000 outbreaks of the plague, scientists from the University of Oslo found that weather in Europe was not a factor, but a warming spell in Asia was. The plague arrived about 15 years after each warming period in Asia. Like today, other factors like immigration and wars also helped spread the disease. So we don't know all the surprises coming our way as this next warming pumps up the population of disease-bearing organisms. Oh, and by the way, a brand new deadly virus was just discovered in a man in Kansas at the end of this February. He'd been bitten by ticks in the spring of 2014. It took a while for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control to realize this was a brand new virus never before seen. The best we can do about all this, Brooks says, is A, admit that climate change is real, and then B, start funding research and building infrastructure to deal with new pests and diseases. We know they're coming. Right now, even in the West, hospitals are operating on a just barely basis. Agriculture is likewise dependent on a business model with no backup system and no fallback position. It's not like we are rationally ready for 1,000 challenges from the micro world, much less from the insects. That's our time for this week. There are some solutions, but they all start with accepting what is real. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week on Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Conlon has dropped in. You remember him with the striped shirt and everything. You recognized him immediately. How are you doing, Phil?
Excellent. Good afternoon, Phil. Happy to be here.
Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m.
Absolutely.
Never misses it. And today we're going to talk about Austin Clark. He just died at the age of 81, and he was one of the world. He's one of Canada's in Barbados' gift to the world, an author, and also many years as an activist. He struggled against racism. He taught at Yale and Duke, and he knew Malcolm X. We're going to talk today with an old friend of his, Norman Otis Richmond, our bluesologist and good friend. Later we're going to – and I have a word, too, about developments in Eritrea. We'll get to that. And then we will have Glenn Ford – discussing the U.S. presidential race and his reaction to Brexit. I really haven't learned to say that yet. It's breakfast. Maybe it's a dog's breakfast. And then we will be speaking to a member of the United Auto Workers, Unifor, from Oshawa Local 222. The question is, are they going to shut down? Is GM planning on an exit from Oshawa? And there's a battle going on waged by Unifor. So we'll be speaking to Mr. Tony Leah. And we will wind up today with Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. And he's also on Twitter. So these days I just say, look it up. You know how to do that. Just further, we're waiting for Otis to join us. I just say that, again, Austin Clark died at the age of 81. He won the Giller Prize for his novel Polished Hoe. He had a great style, a great prose style. He was a very warm man and a very passionate man. He had a terrific demeanor about him. Phil, you remember.
And I had the pleasure of meeting him once, and he was a really delightful person. And
I recall he came to a couple of events. We had Ishmael Reed here on the weekend, right. And the previous time that Ishmael was here, I had the pleasure of joining the two of them, and they had taught together at the same university. We're joined now by bluesologist Norman Otis Richmond. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir.
Hey, thank you very much.
I hope you can hear me.
Yes, yes, indeed, we can. And you're recognizable a mile away. Norman, you knew Austin Clark. We were just talking about his kind of role in our city, and, of course, he's known to World Letters before his many novels and stories. And you knew him. Give us some thoughts about him and what he was like as an individual and what he meant to you.
Well, first of all, when I first came to Toronto, I came to Toronto as a person who refused to go to Vietnam. And one of the first people to welcome me to the city of Toronto was Austin Clark. Austin and Betty Clark, his wife, and he used to live on Asquith Street where the same street the Toronto Public Library is. And I remember he invited me into his house. He showed me the chair in which Malcolm X had sat in. You know, that was one of his prized possessions. Uh-huh. He talked about, the fact that he had, met Malcolm in Harlem, and then Malcolm visited Toronto shortly before he was assassinated. And he came to Austin's house, and they had sat there and listened to, John Coltrane. I think you played Coltrane in the beginning of your show, I believe.
We intend to.
I think you're right.
Somebody's saying, yes, we did. So you know your music.
He talked about Malcolm, but, mm-hmm. And I found out later that, before I had come to Canada, the there was a group of people, I think it was Howard Matthews, who's still in the land of the living, who's the husband of Salome Bay, and Austin Clark and others had done a tribute to Malcolm X, I think in 1966, and in 1967, a group that I belong to called the Afro-American Progressive Association, we organized a tribute to Malcolm X. But I remember I used to go to Austin's house, and you know, you'd walk into Austin's house, and the first thing Austin would, he would open up the door, and the first thing would ask you is, "Are you feeling peckish?" And then he would go to the kitchen and invite you into the kitchen, and he would begin, as a Barbadian, say, to talk a whole lot of shite. And he would just talk and talk, and he welcomed me as a, I guess he was, you know, 10, 11, 12 years older than me. I didn't know how old he was until, you know, I read his obituary. Yeah. But he welcomed me as a, like a little brother. And because I had refused to go to Vietnam, that was one of the, I think, things that I think that attracted to him. But the other thing I think was we had mutual respect for the music called jazz. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Austin Clark was a man who loved Coltrane. He loved Miles Davis. He talked about Paul Chambers. That's a bass player. And he talked about Brohena Ibn Abdullah. That's Art Blakey. He says Art Blakey was his favorite drummer. And I had seen Art Blakey. I had seen Coltrane. In fact, I had met John Coltrane and saw John Coltrane many, many times. So we had that in common. And
He had Malcolm and you had Coltrane. That's a good mix.
And but he liked Beethoven, and he liked classical music as well. And I used to, you know, I'm a victim of the public school system in Los Angeles, and they had us, they used to force us to listen to Bach and Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was used to Jimmy Reed and Howlin' Wolf and, you know, Smokey Robinson and Billie Holiday and people like that. And I begin to, you know, appreciate classical music. You know, I really got hooked up into, like, Rachmaninoff. So Austin influenced me to, like, you know, listen to some of the classical music because he was a well-rounded human being, you know.
Yeah. He, by the way, had been an athlete, right?
He was a track man. Yeah,
track and field.
He ran track and field, and you know,
people talk about these graceful movements. You know, sprinters do move different than other people.
I think Norman Manley was a sprinter too. Norman Manley and Michael Manley, I believe. But
see,
I
think we're outing Norman all Manley, these sprinters.
Yeah, Norman Manley. I think at one time, Norman Manley, the Michael Manley's father was a superb sprinter. I mean, so you know, when we think about Usain Bolt, we have to go back to.
It's a tradition.
Yes.
This is Norman Otis Richmond. By the way, now Austin Clark also was the managing editor of Contrast, and Contrast was on the front lines in the struggle against racism.
Yes. Jojo Chinto and Austin Clark were the editors at Contrast at that time. And Jojo Chinto and myself and Jojo's wife, Ama Chinto, we went to see Austin on Father's Day, and I saw him. I went to see him on Saturday and Sunday, Father's Day, and he was involved in Contrast and put together. You know, he was one of the pioneers in terms of Contrast. Contrast was an African Canadian weekly that was started by Alfred W. Hamilton, who was from Calgary, I think. Al was from Calgary, but Al was a pioneer in the, you know, the black press here. Mm-hmm. I think we had the Canadian Negro, and the Canadian Negro was before Contrast, but you know, the Canadian Negro couldn't get any advertising because they were between me, you, and the lamppost. They were either in or close to the Communist Party of Canada. And, you know, so they couldn't go.
You left a lot of clues in there.
Yeah, and they couldn't get the advertising. Mm-hmm. But Al Hamilton was more. Al Hamilton always told me he was really an NDP man. But the NDP at that time, people didn't feel the NDP could win, so he supported the Liberal Party. You know, but he was a left leaning person himself.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure glad we're talking about Austin Clark. I'm glad that you got to see him on Father's Day. I can't think of a better time, better opportunity for you. That I think that's. And he's 81 years old. He had won all the prizes. We're going to play some of that Coltrane you mentioned. And Norman, thank you very much for talking about Austin Clark.
Thank you for inviting me. Anytime you need me, I'll be here.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear some John Coltrane.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Scott Swenson of Common Cause, who discusses his group's concern about the Supreme Court's recent ruling overturning former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell's conviction on corruption charges. Joshua Prebanek, executive editor of the Public Herald, who talks about his investigation that revealed how government agencies have suppressed public complaints about water contamination linked with fracking. And Andrew Hanauer of the Jubilee USA Network, who assesses the benefits and negative aspects of the Puerto Rico Oversight Management and Economic Stability Act, recently passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Massive budget cuts in Brazil have grounded police helicopters and parked police cars as local governments are conserving cash on the eve of the August Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. Rio State Governor Francisco Dornelles declared a financial emergency as budgets for public services were slashed and police departments were forced to solicit donations to carry out routine activities. Brazil's economy shrank by 4% last year, hitting Rio hard, all in the midst of the impeachment of the nation's president, Dilma Rousseff, and an anti-corruption probe that has implicated dozens of politicians and corporate executives. According to the Guardian newspaper, public employees, including teachers and doctors, have seen delays in receiving their salaries, provoking protest occupations of schools and hospitals. Yet, Rio plans to deploy 85,000 police officers and soldiers during the three-week Summer Games, double the security mobilization for the 2012 London Olympics. Up to 500,000 foreign tourists are expected in Rio for the Games, in spite of warnings about the Zika virus. Rio's police chief, Fernando Veloso, told O Globo News in a recent interview, "We're at the limit of our operational capacity, and I can't discard the possibility of a collapse." Hours after U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced a civil rights investigation into the Chicago Police Department, Chicago Fraternal Order of Police President Dean Angelo flew to Washington, D.C. to meet with officials at the U.S. Department of Justice. The city had recently released a dash cam video of Officer Jason Van Dyke killing 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Graphic footage showed the officer firing a hail of bullets at the black teen as he walked away. In the wake of McDonald's death, the union has faced growing public scrutiny over its alleged role in shielding his killer. Officer Van Dyke faced 20 civilian complaints over a decade, including accusations of using excessive force. The Obama administration has launched civil rights investigations in cities like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, the scenes of high-profile police killings. According to In These Times magazine, analysis of past Department of Justice investigations show a mixed record, some revealing a lack of cooperation from police officials and their unions. Many police unions have won protections for rank-and-file officers in their contracts, including authorizing delays in giving statements after a shooting, which may give officers time to confer and get their story straight, and a statute of limitations on disciplinary consequences. In April, the Chicago Police Accountability Task Force observed, "The collective bargaining agreements have essentially turned a code of silence into official policy." But community activists hope the federal investigation into the Chicago Police Department will reassess union rules and promote reforms to increase accountability when police officers kill civilians. On July 1st, Vermont became the first state in the nation to require the labeling of foods containing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. It is the culmination of years of organizing by food activists in the face of resistance from giant food corporations over what is disclosed on a food label. Many critics of GMOs say genetically engineered foods are neither regulated nor safe and can harm human health in ways that scientists don't fully understand. But now, there's growing concern among GMO labeling advocates that Vermont's historic law would be overturned by a proposed federal law that would deny consumers information on what's in the food they're buying. Politicians introduced federal legislation developed by giant food corporations that the consumers' right community has dubbed Deny Americans the Right to Know, or DARK Act. Vermont is the second smallest state in the nation in terms of population, but a hub for organic farmers and farmers' markets. It is also home to many struggling dairy farmers who rely on GMOs to cut costs and who worry about keeping family farms profitable. Critics complain that the spread of GMOs into industrial monoculture has harmed soil health. There are similar debates about whether GMOs increase pesticide use and ultimately threaten the global food supply. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In a unanimous decision handed down on June 27th, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the corruption conviction of former Virginia Governor Robert F. McDonnell. In September 2014, a jury unanimously convicted Governor McDonnell and his wife Maureen of public corruption, finding that the couple had used the governor's office to assist Johnny R. Williams Sr., a wealthy dietary supplement company executive, advance his business interests. In exchange, Williams gave the McDonald's $177,000 in loans and gifts, including a Rolex watch, vacations, partial payments for a daughter's wedding reception, and $20,000 in designer clothing and accessories. The Supreme Court decision to vacate the conviction means that the former Republican governor, who was once mentioned as a possible GOP presidential candidate, will not have to serve a 2-year sentence, and his wife will avoid serving her 1-year-and-a-day prison term. In rendering their opinion, the justices stated that instructions to the jury in this case on what constitutes official acts was too broad. The High Court remanded the case back to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit to determine if there is sufficient evidence to justify a new trial. Your reporter spoke with Scott Svensson, Vice President for Communications with Common Cause. Here he discusses the overturning of the McDonald conviction and the dangerous precedent he believes it sets for making it more difficult to prosecute office holders who sell political access and influence to the highest bidder.
It's very clear this is not politics as usual by any stretch of the imagination. There's ample evidence that Governor McDonald took gifts and loans provided by his friend, Mr. Williams, accepted vacations, a Rolex watch, $20,000 shopping spree, $15,000 in catering expenses for their daughter's wedding, tens of thousands of dollars in private loans in exchange for Governor McDonald promoting Mr. Williams' product, and using the privileges and power that come with the office of the governor of any state, in this case Virginia, to host events and to give the state's official seal of approval to this product and to this business. In one instance, McDonald emailed Williams asking about a $50,000 loan, and 6 minutes later sent another email to his staff requesting an update on the scientific research surrounding Williams' products. So you see a very clear line between the money coming in or the request for the money and the governor's interest in this case.
Tell our listeners about what the Supreme Court unanimous decision says that threw out the corruption conviction against Bob McDonald. What was the rationale for the Supreme Court in making this ruling?
It's a little hard to discern. They have been very clear that quid pro quo corruption in every other case is usually what they cite. This is as clear a case of pay-to-play quid pro quo corruption as you could find, and yet they managed to weasel out of this. It's clear we can't rely on federal laws any longer to protect and preserve our democracy, but we're not left empty-handed. We, as organizers and people, need to start to work on small donor campaign finance reform and gift campaign finance laws at the local and state level so that we can demand consistency in our jurisprudence, the law for the court, and that we can rid the country of pay-to-pay politics. The president is sitting on an executive order that would deal with this directly on the federal level. In Virginia, Governor McDonnell, other governors in the states have very specific disclosure laws that rule against pay-to-play politics or shine a light on them. So they are, it's a prophylactic. It prevents people from wanting to take advantage of the system. Virginia just doesn't have that in place. And so the people of Virginia have to get those laws in place. Other states obviously should be doing the same thing. Because right now we've got a court that's playing politics. And if you get, you know, one decision on one day that looks like it's going in one direction, and the very next day you get this decision, which says quid pro quo, we don't see that here. That is a court that is out of balance and out of touch with where the American people are. And we've got to have stricter campaign finance laws to make sure that we can correct for that.
What precedent does this Supreme Court case send to the rest of the country? Many critics have said this is hands down going to make it much more difficult for the government to prove corruption charges against elected officials who take gifts, who accept remuneration for favors given.
Absolutely. And there is no doubt about it. Unless and until this ruling is corrected in terms of the remand of the lower court and vacated by the high court, that they get a different decision from the lower court that can be affirmed, this is sending a signal that pay-to-play politics is alive and well. There are very, very few cases of actual sort of, you know, money exchanging hands from one to the other, as we've sometimes seen in you know, sort of grainy video shot by undercover cameras and whatnot in the Abscam trials or other things like that. That sort of corruption, that sort of here's $1 billion that I'm going to give you in a briefcase, and now you're going to do me this favor, that just is pretty far afield from what happens in Washington. What happens, like in the McDonald case, is legal. And it's only different by inches from someone handing over a bag of cash and saying, I want you to do this favor for me or for my business. In this case, no votes. It was still a way of using the official apparatus of the state of Virginia and its scientific and business acumen and authority to lend credence and credibility to this gentleman's product and help him make lots of money. And that is an exchange of money and goods or money and services, however you want to frame it, that sure seems like it opens the door now with this particular ruling to more rampant pay-to-play politics in the country. The most important thing for your listeners to know tonight is that all is not lost. People are working very hard, smart, thoughtful lawyers across this country, in think tanks and activists around this country, are working very hard to put together reform measures that will ensure democracy remains of, by, and for the people and doesn't get sold out to the highest bidder. We're in a very dark moment in our history right now. There is no question about that.
That was Scott Svensson, Vice President for Communications with Common Cause. Find more commentary and analysis on the McDonald case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the past decade, Pennsylvania has been ground zero for fracking, the industrial fossil fuel extraction process that requires 1 million gallons of water, sand, and hundreds of unknown chemicals for each gas well drilled. Families living near such wells have complained that fracking has contaminated their drinking water, but in most cases, they haven't been able to prove it. A series of investigations by ProPublica, the Center for Public Integrity, Harvard University, and others all revealed problems with Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection's lack of enforcement and follow-through on suspected cases of water contamination linked to fracking. Last fall, Public Herald, a nonprofit investigative news organization based in Pittsburgh, released a report that found 9 different ways the state has kept complaints out of the public record. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joshua Perbanek, executive editor of the Public Herald, who explains that after a court case was won by another news outlet, he and his partner were able for the first time to get access to 2,300 complaint investigations. The Herald is now calling for a federal investigation of both the Pennsylvania DEP and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. which in 2015 issued a report stating there was no evidence of a serious problem with the state's drinking water due to fracking. The report, however, did not cite any of the thousands of complaints in making its determination. Here, Joshua Probanek discusses his investigation.
Initially, what tipped us off in the records was not actually something that we were able to find at the department. We had a source who had contacted us about contaminated water. We went out and looked at their case that the department handled, and we were able to get the records from the source because they were delivered to them from the DEP. And when we looked through them, we started to see really serious problems with the DEP's decision-making. For instance, you know, this particular person ended up having a clean pre-drill test. Okay, they had a very clean baseline, no contaminants in their water supply. And then in post-drill, after the drilling happened in, I think it was 2010 or whatnot, they had spikes in arsenic, they had spikes in methane, they ended up having an introduction of radon into their water, so there was a possible contamination of radium-226 or 228, and there was some illegal activity that happened from the company, which the company illegally buried a waste pit on the site, and the department just created a new permit for them so that they didn't have to hold the company accountable and issue any fines or violations. So we had a lot of red flags with this particular case. And when we went to go look at the record for this person in the DEP's office, not a single part related to the water contamination was inside of the record at the department. So that was extremely disturbing for us. Number one, that we could not see those records. Number two, they ended up ruling that this particular person, that the operator was not responsible for contamination to their water supply. And that ruling wasn't based on any kind of scientific decision. That ruling was based on something called the Section 3218 of Chapter 58 of Pennsylvania's Oil and Gas Act. And that states that the company is presumed responsible when the complaint comes in if the complaint is made within 6 months of the drilling being started. However, what that does not mean is that the department automatically can rule a case to be non-impact if a person makes a complaint after 6 months. And that's exactly what they told this person. Oh, we're sorry, you made your complaint after 6 months, therefore we cannot hold the company liable for contamination to your water supply, case closed. So it's a clear misinterpretation of the Pennsylvania law by the Department of Environmental Protection for one reason or another. And as we started to dig through these cases, that particular pattern, so they had misinterpreted this law, made that decision, and dismissed pre-drill tests, happened again and again and again and again. So it wasn't just this isolated case.
The previous governor, Republican Tom Corbett, was extremely pro-fracking. Joshua Probanek, have you seen any change in the oversight of fracking since Democrat Tom Wolf came in, whom I'm sure appointed his own head of DEP?
Since Wolf took office in 2015, we've scanned and reported on scanned records of water contamination complaints during his time in office, and we've also reported on large plumes of contamination that have happened during his time in office. And to be quite honest with you, we were hopeful that when Wolf took office, we would be able to sit down with the department or sit down with Wolf, explain what we had seen during the Corbett administration, and expect some kind of task force to be created to address the issues and get this dealt with, so people could be vindicated, get cases reopened, get new decisions, new determinations made by the state for these cases. And the secretary, John Quigley, who was the secretary of BEP that was recently resigned, refused to meet with us to discuss the issue in two different occasions. In fact, our experience with this administration at this point, it is not only just the same as it was with the Corbett administration, but getting much worse because they have not reined in, they have not created any accountability for the egregious actions that have been perpetuated by the DEP at this point in their decision-making. I can say that we are up to nearly 15 different patterns that we've discovered how DEP covers up cases, and three of those patterns came from the time when Governor Tom Wolf has been in office.
What would you like to see happen next as a result of your investigation?
We have called for a federal criminal investigation
the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the U.S. EPA due to the findings that we discovered in our complaint report, our September 2015 complaint report, where we released 9 ways that the department covered up water contamination related to drinking water complaints from fracking. And I think that really the only path forward here is to begin a congressional hearing, to bring in the inspectors at the department, to bring in the supervisors at the department, to bring in the administrative staff at the Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, and also to bring those same people in from the EPA who handled complaint cases in Pennsylvania and who were responsible for the national study that was released.
That was Joshua Probenik of the Pittsburgh-based Public Herald. Learn more about the Herald's investigation into water contamination linked with fracking by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After months of congressional inaction on Puerto Rico's looming debt crisis, President Obama signed into law the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, known by its acronym PROMESA, or Promise in Spanish. The new oversight board was authorized on June 30th, just before a July 1st deadline for the island's government to make a $2 billion payment to creditors that Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro García Padilla, says they cannot pay. The island defaulted on an earlier payment in May. Although Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, because it's not a state, the island is not allowed to restructure its daunting $72 billion debt under Chapter 9, the way bankrupt cities like Detroit have done. President Obama and supporters of PROMESA maintain that the measure will provide more stability, better services, and greater prosperity over the long term for the people of Puerto Rico. But many opponents of the PROMESA bill say that Puerto Rico shouldn't pay its debts to enrich Wall Street profiteers. They point to the fact that $33.5 billion of the $72 billion in debt is actually interest on capital appreciation bonds, representing 785% interest on an earlier $4.3 billion loan. Critics also oppose the structure of the oversight board, which would not be accountable to the island government and requires that only one of its 7 members resides or has a business in Puerto Rico. The board will have control over Puerto Rico's future budget, financial plans, and regulations. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Hanauer, Jubilee USA Network's campaigns director, who examines the strengths and weaknesses of the PROMESA legislation and the long-term economic challenges facing the people of Puerto Rico.
$72 billion in debt, about $20,000 per person on the island. So, you know, in Puerto Rico, you have a couple sort of unique factors. One is that, you know, Puerto Rico's, you know, essentially colonial status, which has allowed it to be treated unfairly under U.S. law for a number of years. So that a number of laws imposed on Puerto Rico have negatively impacted both its economy and also its ability to get out of debt. For instance, Puerto Rico is excluded from the same bankruptcy protection that's offered to U.S. states. And the second thing is that Puerto Rico has sort of the unique situation in which its residents, if they decide that there aren't enough economic opportunities in Puerto Rico, they don't need a passport. They just get on an airplane and fly to the United States and the mainland, and they can take up residence there. And so over the last decade, Puerto Rico has lost something like 10% of its population to people leaving mostly for places like Florida and New York. And so the end result is a sort of an economic death spiral where more and more people leave. They're the people who can afford plane tickets. So the tax base is eroded and good professionals in good paying jobs are leaving. And it's negatively impacting the whole island.
Tell us about the recent congressional action addressing Puerto Rico's debt crisis, something called the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, or PROMESA. What is PROMESA, and what will it do to help Puerto Rico in assessing the pros and cons of that legislation?
What this bill does is really 2 main things. First, it gives Puerto Rico tools to restructure its debt. So basically, it creates breathing space. It puts a stop on lawsuits from creditors, and it creates a system
whereby Puerto Rico can bring, you know, its creditors to the table, negotiate a solution, and then make sure that that solution happens and basically force what we would call vulture funds or holdout creditors to agree to that solution, even if they don't want to. If in other words, if the majority of creditors agree to a deal, then you can't have holdouts. Everyone has to agree to it. The second thing it does, which is, you know, certainly controversial, is it creates an oversight board. And this oversight board has the ability to review budgets passed by Puerto Rico and has some ability to, you know, make decisions around those budgets and Puerto Rico's decision finances. We don't necessarily think that's the answer to Puerto Rico's problems, and I think we certainly have a lot of concern about Puerto Rico's colonial status. I think this bill overall, though, was absolutely necessary to stave off a significant economic collapse because Puerto Rico defaulted on its debt just this past Friday. And if it didn't have these tools in place, we would have seen, I think, very serious consequences.
One of the provisions, I believe, is that this oversight board really only has to have one person on it who is Puerto Rican themselves, who lives in Puerto Rico. That means, to some critics, that Puerto Rico itself won't be well represented on this board, and any kind of local control is extremely in jeopardy.
Yeah, absolutely. And we agree with those critics. We have pushed, since this bill was introduced, to change that. We would like to see Puerto Ricans on this board. You know, if this board is going to exist, we want it to be as democratic as possible and to respect Puerto Rico's democracy as much as possible. So, you know, that's certainly a problem, and we agree with that. This bill is very flawed. It has flaws. Just like any bill that is, you know, a bipartisan compromise, you're going to have provisions that both sides have problems with. But this bill does a lot of really, really good things. And I think in the end, the question was, is there an alternative? The answer was no, there was no alternative. So, you know, we believe that passing this bill was necessary to deal with Puerto Rico's debt crisis, which is the most immediate short-term concern. And I think now the question is, who will be on this oversight board? How will Puerto Rico be represented on this oversight board? And how do we move forward so that we can address Puerto Rico's status and really begin to long-term create an economic structure that's going to benefit Puerto Rico's people?
That was Andrew Hanauer, Jubilee USA Network's campaigns director. Find more perspectives on Puerto Rico's debt crisis and the PROMESA plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hale and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Family and friends joins a tragic train of death. Mike Brown, Rakia Boyd, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, and on and on and on, all killed by cops just doing their jobs. At times like these, elections seem irrelevant, for they have no answer to this gnawing state of terror. No answer at all. Why should they? They were architects of it. They campaign for these killers. They approve their militarization. The politicians running for office or running from office today were gung-ho for cops yesterday, sending them more and more of the people's tax dollars and more weapons of war. What did they expect? Now, within hours of Sterling's killing, another black man, Philando Castile, is gunned down in his car, sitting beside his lover, while reaching for his ID and registration demanded by a traffic cop. Another one gone. And another. And another. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My name is Bernadette Devlin McAllister. Mumia Abu-Jamal's deep and resonant voice has been silenced and censored. I will read to you one of his illuminating commentaries, written on the occasion of Nelson Mandela's visit to Philadelphia in 1993. Its message is still relevant today. These words were handwritten in a solitary confinement cell by a man awaiting execution. Mumia begins with a passage from Mandela's speech that quotes Frederick Douglass. What to a prisoner is the 4th of July? At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability, and could I reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all the other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. To the slave, your shouts of liberty and equality are hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. End quote. Frederick Douglass on July the 5th, 1852. July 4th, 1993 saw African National Congress President Nelson Mandela in Philadelphia quoting this Frederick Douglass speech as he accepted the Liberty Medal along with South African State President F.W. de Klerk. If the joint presence of Mandela and de Klerk were not enough to stir controversy, then the award presenters, Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell and U.S. President Clinton, certainly stoked controversy amongst radicals. Hundreds of black Philadelphians, while certainly admirers of Mandela, took umbrage at de Klerk's presence. Although we, the awarders, are known as we, the people, Philadelphia, the actual everyday people of Philadelphia had little say in choosing the Liberty Medal awardees, and less say in rejecting the widely unpopular honoree de Klerk. The choice of Liberty Medalists was not made by the people, but by corporate Philadelphia, big business. Why? Why were the people, many of whom had worked for more than 20 years against apartheid and for Mandela's release, frozen out? Their protests against de Klerk all but ignored. When the African majority takes power in South Africa, U.S. big business wants friends there. If one reads the names of corporate sponsors of the Liberty Medal, it sounds like roll call of the Chamber of Commerce, Unisys Corp, Pennsylvania Bell, and the like. Mandela, who has not voted in a government election in 74 years, and de Klerk, president by way of an election counting only minority non-black votes, has only the hope of liberty. No more. The white majority in South Africa has done its level best to stifle African liberty for 300 years. The African majority, even after the awards, still isn't free.
Islamophobia is rearing its ugly head here at Warren Correctional. Really, it's been something of a staple of the prison complex dating back to the events leading up to the Lucasville Uprising. Back then, prison officials provoked Muslim prisoners by refusing basic accommodations and contributing to even greater tension. When prison officials' nonsense eventually sparked a riot, as part distraction and part spectacle, they framed up Muslim prisoners as leaders of the riot, going so far as to doctor surveillance recordings in order to frame Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, a Muslim prisoner at Lucasville. Sadiq has been on death row ever since, even though experts confirmed that the audio recordings used to put him there were spliced, adding Sadiq into conversations where he wasn't actually present. Yes, Ohio prison officials will go to crazy lengths in order to assassinate Muslim prisoners. Here at Warren Correctional, prison officials haven't proposed killing Muslims yet.
but they do possess the heavy equipment to dig the mass grave in the softball diamond, so stay tuned. The latest round of Islamophobic attacks began when mailroom and commissary staff conspired to convince Muslim prisoners that a 30-year policy providing for the purchase of prayer oil was rescinded, when it really wasn't. The lie they told was that prisoners at some other prison were using modified pop cans and desk lamps to burn prayer oil as incense, and as a consequence, prayer oil was banned. It wasn't, of course, but nobody knew that. Recent inquiries, the central office revealed that the policy hasn't changed at all. Of course, Muslims have been prevented from prayer oil purchases for months and months, and there still is no clarification as to how Muslim prisoners can go about obtaining it. So the effective ban will likely continue for several more months. Nothing at all has been done to the staff, who foreclosed on Muslims' religious rights through fraud. At the same time, prison staffers banned prayer on the recreation yard. While on its face such a ban seems inclusive to every religion, consider that prayer, for everyone but Muslims, can be done inconspicuously. For Muslims, the process of prayer involves a specific ritual of standing and bowing and prostrations, actions that are identifiable as prayer. So when Mustafa Harwell attempted to pray on the recreation yard, he was surrounded by staff and roughly led away. When he wrote up a complaint about it, they called him a gang member and sent him off to Lucasville. He's in K Block now. So the ODRC, as part of its rehabilitative program, designed to instill greater respect for law, has suspended the Constitution and enforced prayer-free zones. No member of other religions are faced with gang transfers for praying, but Muslims are. Simultaneous to banning prayer oil through fraud and cracking down on communication with Allah, the ODRC refuses to provide Muslims a religious diet, referred to as an halal diet. This is the Muslim equivalent to the Jewish kosher diet. The irony is, the ODRC recognizes kosher diet in policy while denying the Islamic equivalent entirely. All of this taken together gives Muslim prisoners the distinct impression that the ODRC holds a grudge. The situation exemplifies the prison hierarchy's silliness, their sneaky provocations that originate from some really deep-seated hatred and hostility, an irrational hatred and hostility, a bigotry born of stupidity that only flourishes in hierarchy disorder. So, on the eve of Ramadan, Muslim prisoners in Ohio are praying for basic fundamental accommodations. Well, when the guards aren't looking anyway. This is anarchist prisoner Abu Huraira Asim al-Quraish. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. The Geopolitical Economy Research Group was founded in January of 2015. GERG is a policy research institute conducting high-quality research and analysis dealing with nations and their relation to the world economy. It aims to critically analyze and propose policy alternatives for managing the interaction of national economies and states to promote human development and mutual benefit in today's multipolar world. In September of 2015, the group held its inaugural event at the University of Manitoba, where it is headquartered. The event was entitled, From the 30 Years Crisis to Multipolarity, the Geopolitical Economy of the 21st Century World. On today's program, we're going to hear audio from a panel discussion at the conference. The presentation was entitled, Terror Information and State Secrecy. State governments have long sought to conceal sensitive information from the prying eyes of the public. government instruments such as freedom of information requests are seemingly losing their effectiveness as a means to overcome state secrecy. There is a growing awareness that clandestine discussions within and between nations are favoring major corporate centers of power while excluding the broad citizenry. Emerging over the last decade has been multiple internet platforms, WikiLeaks being chief among these, which allow whistleblowers to upload documents to the World Wide Web for all to see. This form of grassroots hacktivism challenges government control of information and brings substance to the democratic virtue of transparency and openness. Binoy Kampmark spoke at the Geopolitical Economy and Research Group conference on this topic. He's the author of a 2015 paper entitled The Transparency Movement in Geopolitical Economy, WikiLeaks, Economic Diplomacy, and the Redistribution of Power. Binoy Kampmark was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge. He is currently a senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies, teaching within the Bachelor of Social Science program in Legal and Dispute Studies. His research and teaching interests lie in the intersections of law, international relations, and history. In his presentation, he invoked the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and some of the leaks which have revealed aspects to the deal detrimental to the public interest. So here is Binoy Kampmark from September 2015.
So the first thing to point out here is the notion of this type of activism that I would like to refer to. So some call it a hacktosphere, a technosphere, whatever you'd like to deem it. This is sort of nerd central traditionally. Okay? This is a sort of area where individuals with rather bad skin get clogged up and sit in front of a computer for 24 hours. But the actual fact of this, and this is the point to keep in mind, work has been done about it in the context of looking at how such activity has been linked to various spaces of engagement that we're now familiar with today. So, for example, what we see now is a combination of journalism, combination of blogging, combination of various social media activism, and, of course, the legal representation, the legal element of it is important too. A range of individuals who have plugged into these various, if you like, spaces of engagement, which are potentially very exciting, if indeed you are looking at the way government functions, but also the way government doesn't, in some cases, function, keeping information out of the way and so forth. And it is important to understand how that works. Traditionally, information, of course, the arbiter of information, irrespective of what government policy suggests, will always be government. The assumption is a paternalistic one. The assumption always is, we have the information, and, well, you will eventually get some of it through leaked, through gradual process of, for example, declassification programs. There might be, of course, archival programs. And then there is the dispensation that's offered by freedom of information. But freedom of information, of course, does not guarantee when you're putting a request, depending again on which country it's in, but generally speaking, freedom of information is available in many Western states. But the thing is, there is always a limitation to freedom of information, because you can still apply for it, and some of you, I'm sure, have probably tried this process, and then you will receive a document which is almost totally blanked out. So it's not as if the process hasn't been complied with. It has been, but you receive essentially a useless document. So that's the process. You get a blank document, or a blacked out document, as it were, which is not very useful. The other thing to keep in mind is that when this is challenged in the courts, it's a very familiar test that you always hear, which is the public interest test. But it's not the public interest test for people to know. It is the public interest test for people not to know. That it would be injurious to the public interest to know what the government's up to. Well, yes, of course it would be injurious to know. That's exactly the point. But the whole issue, of course, is that the emphasis is reversed from the public interest of knowing to the public interest of not knowing. And that's an important point to keep in mind, how that particular test functions. And then, of course, the other technique, or the other method, if you like, is the notion of other methods where information was obtained, be it, for example, via whistleblowing, which has, of course, landed individuals in a considerable amount of strife. I don't need to tell you that in the context of WikiLeaks, of course, Chelsea Manning is paying a very high price for the disclosure of documents that ultimately led to Cablegate, as it's been termed. And then there is, of course, the traditional hacker and so forth, where that's particularly linked. But in terms of the whistleblowing aspect, I also want to point out something. I always get very suspicious when there is a supposedly new whistleblower law coming about to protect whistleblowing, because, again, just as the onus in freedom of information is designed to prevent the public from actually knowing in their good name, the whistleblower is presumed initially not to be doing the right thing. You see, this is the problem with whistleblower legislation. The assumption is that you have done the wrong thing, and then you must justify that you did the right thing. So it is a retrospective validation about an act to begin with. And that is how the institutionalized establishment retains control of information, so that effectively the information is kept, as I like calling it, in the family or the mafia. So effectively, the security mafia or the intelligence establishment or whatever it might be, it may not necessarily be that that valuable information, but to give you an example, the various countries, the UK, for example, or Australia, do have very strong laws, very punitive laws for the disclosure of any information as a public servant, former or ex, former or current. So it doesn't actually matter that it's about the number of biscuits in the jar of the Secretary of State. Okay, that's punishable. 2 years in prison by just disclosing that fact. Now, that's the law as it is. The Public Interest Disclosure Act that was passed in Australia last year has been hollowed out extensively by new rules and regulations that show that Edward Snowden never happened. And in fact, that's the very interesting thing about this whole thing. This entire movement about supposed protection of disclosure, so-called public internal disclosure, which you can see the problem with that, it's internal. It's called public internal disclosure. It's very peculiar. So, but anyway, the point I simply want to draw with that is this enveloping notion of information, which then presents us with a situation such as publishing in the format of a WikiLeaks experiment, if you like. That's what bridges the gap and so forth. And the examples connected with that I want to discuss are, of course, those connected with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, I want to add, only one of a series of a triad of agreements that will ultimately encompass the globe. Well, with the exception of BRICS countries, that's the thing. The whole point about these particular agreements act, if you look carefully at the geographical nexus and component of it, as an envelopment, you know, that comprises something like 50 countries and, you know, literally two-thirds of the GDP of the world. You know, more of that later. But to continue on the actual dimensions of this type of activism, I want to refer to the work of John Postel, who's done some work in this area, quite interesting. He's argued for what he calls the mainstreaming of nerd politics. He actually argues that this particular situation is facing us today. And what is interesting to see is the use of, for example, actor network theory that Latour discusses, and how it relates to social processes as humans, human agency, human engagement, but also the use of inanimate processes in linked with that, with the activism. So, for example, the use of the internet, the use of social media, of course, the uploading of documents that might be deemed of a sensitive nature. In other words, it's the naturalization of that sort of technology that's taking place as we speak. Now, Postel argues that we need to describe such activism in a new light, namely, that there are components and groups of people that take advantage, if you like, of societal forces that we see happening, be it, for example, what led to the Arab Spring, be it examples that lead to Cablegate and so on and so forth. So these are anywhere, from what I said before, bloggers, hacktivists. There might be technology lawyers. There might be social media netizens and so forth. Now, he calls them freedom technologists. He calls them freedom technologists who use specific type of protest formula to engage, for example, the exposure of corruption of particular individuals. You could already see this happening, for example, in 2001 with the use of mobile phone technology with Estrada in the Philippines. You could also see this And this was already happening even before the WikiLeaks cables in Tunisia with Ben Ali, because you could already see that what was happening there was a broader discussion, new spaces of engagement that, in effect, the government wasn't even observing. In effect, it was taking place ahead of government regulations, ahead of the actual, if you like, orthodoxy of the time. Now, the important thing is, Postel suggests that we should not be as negative about these technologies as some people have been. And I understand where they're coming from. People like Yevgeny Morozov, for example, who makes the very important point that this sort of, you know, liberation idea behind technology can also be fraught with danger. You know, he calls them slacktivists and, of course, techno-delusionists. And it is important to also understand that it is very hard to gauge causation here necessarily. You know, just because one reads a cable that's been put on the WikiLeaks, you know, via WikiLeaks on the server, does that necessarily mean that, you know, a government's going to fall? Of course, not necessarily. But it is important to realize the combination of factors within the particular phases of how a particular revolt or revolution works. My feeling always has been that, you know, three-quarters of the work is already done by the government if a government falls. You know, in a sense, the explosion or the catalyst comes from these particular range of factors, of which WikiLeaks is one. So a very nice thing that was said, or a very prescient point, was that the collapse or the initiation, perhaps, of the Arab Spring and the collapse of various leaders took place because of Al Jazeera, Emil, and WikiLeaks. Now, of course, it's a bit of simplification, but what it meant is people there looking at television networks, gauging with the material that's coming out, and then, of course, various networked communities protesting and arranging protests through various avenues using material that had come out in the disclosures about the behavior, for example, of, you know, Ben Ali, who had a range of exotic animals and a very strange eating habits with ice cream. So the point about this is to understand that this, what has been termed, if you like, this particular fourth wave of democracy. Now, I don't like these particular categorizations, waves of democracy, new movement, and all of that. But I think it is important to understand that within the context here, we are talking about new spaces of media and engagement, which have not been anticipated by government. Gradually, as governments are starting to get their head around these technologies, they're starting to utilize those same technologies, of course, against individuals who might actually have a sense of them. We see that constantly in terms of social media propaganda units that are funded by various countries. Israel has a very active unit. The Russians are particularly adept at this too. A range of things there which are worth considering. But the point about this particular wave was that it was the creation of new various media channels. It was also the creation of media that was not in the standard state-run aspect. And this, combined with the publishing activism of a group like WikiLeaks or, say, Anonymous, presented itself in a particular formidable way. So that is the activism side of it, that dimension of how activism has utilized the technological framework to create, as it were, a bit of a ruckus as to whether, you know, it creates genuine change or not is, of course, the open question. But the policy behind an organization such as WikiLeaks is that it deals with this notion of transparency. Now, of course, within transparency, there are various schools of thought. The more traditional one that you might be familiar with is associated with Transparency International. Now, Transparency International has essentially an interest in government functions insofar as they affect things like efficiency and so forth. So the notion with Transparency International, generally speaking, I don't want to simplify the platform too much because I do understand that the organization and its various branches does many things. But the important thing to also understand that essentially it's the assumption from an economic rationalist perspective. It's the idea that if you are not transparent, you will be inefficient and so on and so forth. And that's really the line taken by organizations such as the IMF, you know, to use a word that's been used often at this conference, this is a neoliberal framework, if you like, that uses transparency as an argument. So that's why transparency in some instances may have a dirty name, you know, if it's taking that perspective. But this particular point here is a very much public interest driven idea of what's called radical transparency. Or I'd like to give it a little another term, bushranger transparency, you know, vigilante transparency. It's this idea that it is left out there, the material is published, and this particular material is accordingly interpreted in what is called the scientific journalistic sense. At least this is how Julian Assange describes it. Namely, it is unfiltered. You don't actually have a caste, as it were, of individuals engaging this. I see parallels in this with Martin Luther's, of course, stamping of the theses on the wall of the church in Wittenberg. And this is the idea, of course, that God should not be obscured by the priests. You should not have a medium, if you like, intervening that tells you how you should interact with that material. God of the text, the material, of course, being obscured by the priests. So in this particular instance here, what has been described as, and this is a particular line taken from Sifri, the idea is to eliminate the big brother, if you like, that watches from above, and replace that with a flock of little sisters watching government from below. So that's one of the ideas put forth. But then I also want to stress that I'm not suggesting that secrecy is all dirty. I think it's a very important point that in an examination of radical transparency itself, it's not necessarily and does not necessarily mean that you know, we have to abolish all forms of it. I'm just suggesting, as Claire Birchall does, who's done quite a bit of work in radical transparency, Claire Birchall suggests actually that we should see them as feeding off each other rather than totally mutually exclusive of each other. There may be reasons and rooms, and certainly room for engagement in this particular thing. It shouldn't be seen as the notion of transparency as secrecy and secrecy as transparency. We have to try to work out various forms of engagement there in terms of that. Now, what I would like to move on to is, as I said before, to examine the actual Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, if you like, the case study for our discussion today. Now, November 13, 2013, WikiLeaks released the intellectual property rights chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Those of you who are perhaps not familiar with the dimensions of this, it's considerable. 13 countries are involved with negotiations over a range of things, which will be very significant in the long run. They may well affect, for example, the way the internet is used in certain cases, certainly the way medicine is made, the way patents are granted, and the way certain things with intellectual property and the environment are, for example, dealt with. And just incidentally, that on 24th of November, the chapter, the environmental chapter, was released. Now, all of these constitute, as I said before, part of a treaty triad, with the TPP being essentially the icebreaker. Now, the icebreaker here means that effectively the global economy comprising, say, 53 states and 1.6 billion people will be affected by these particular arrangements. They comprise the Trade and Services Agreement, otherwise known as TISA, and also the Transatlantic Investment Agreement, which comprises Europe, the EU. So it's the EU and the US on the one side, and then the US comprised with countries through the Asia-Pacific. So that's effectively rings both with the EU on one side with the Atlantic, and then the Pacific, of course, on the other side with the Asia-Pacific. This is also part of President Obama's pivot strategy as well. So when he made it clear that, and he has said, in fact, a few times that should the TPP pass, and, you know, there is suggestions, there always are suggestions that it will pass soon, but there have been quite a few delays, that if it passes, for example, later this year, it will be one of the crowning achievements of his administration. Well, according to WikiLeaks, they'd like to see what's going on there. So a couple of crowdsource mechanisms have been put into place. Seeking funding, you may or may not be familiar. Your places of employment may frown upon you if you're there browsing the WikiLeaks website. And it has happened. I certainly know of instances, even in a university setting, where students have been found out using that material and gotten into trouble, which is rather curious. I know there was a debate in the United States about whether you could use WikiLeaks cables in class or whether you could tell students to use those cables. I can't speak about it from the Canadian perspective. I'm not sure if it was done here as well. But when Cablegate did come about, various institutions, for example, Georgetown University certainly issued an email specifically in the foreign, in the diplomacy area, that if you are reading WikiLeaks cables, then you are jeopardizing your career, potentially. So the point, but the point about this part, and not wanting to get off that, but get back to specifically obtaining the document, and this is again linked back to that sort of activism. WikiLeaks has is seeking 100,000, so it's through pledges essentially, 100,000 euros for the transatlantic agreement partnership, and for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, $100,000. And the point about this, of course, is actually involving public or citizenry into identifying the remaining chapters of the TPP. So if any one of you have the contents out there, 100,000 up for grabs, depending on which ones, well, what you're looking for. Yeah, so the point about this here is, why the fuss? Now, the thing about it is that the TPP has been considered, for example, NAFTA on steroids. I mean, this will make NAFTA look like a kindergarten sport. Okay, when it comes down to it, I know Ross Perot does make some curious remarks, but you know, he does say that if it is passed, there'll be a big sucking sound of jobs leaving the U.S. But leaving that aside, it's not even the implications of those things. It's also the fact that it is very much in favor of corporates over citizenry. And it also, and this is the thing that's perhaps most striking, it's gagging parliamentarians. It's gagging Congress individuals, congressmen and women, from saying anything about it. You can see it, but you can't speak about it, which is one of the reasons why Senator Elizabeth Warren did actually say that this is in all likelihood probably a bad sign. The fact that the citizens who elect a particular individual can't then expect that individual to tell them exactly what is going on. The actual documents are very interesting to read. They have red lines that show the engagement, for example, of the various parties. So it's a study of forms of diplomacy as well. You can see, for example, the disagreements over fisheries in the environmental chapter. You can see, for example, the disagreement about patents, New Zealand being particularly upset with the United States stance on generic drugs. And the fact that patents will be extended in length and royalties will be extended in length by 20 years. This is one of the proposals. So effectively, that will be an attempt to kill off the generic drugs industry, and rather than encourage innovation, stifle it. This is one of the curious things about it. Other parts of it speak of voluntary compliance of corporations for an environmental code. So effectively, if you notice carefully about it, the environmental chapter is a trade-off for a very forceful IP chapter. In other words, you lessen the environmental protections in favor of corporate copyright issues and IP, which is a very interesting but rather glum sort of thing to look at. It also, certainly the IP chapter, reintroduces SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. The provisions of that act were rejected in Congress, but these provisions are then reinserted into what certainly the document we have looks like. I'm not saying word for word it is, but it's certainly reinserting the spirit of the Piracy Act, which would have, if it had been passed, make ISPs, Internet Service Providers, the police men and women and officers, if you like, of the net, namely to take down particular sites that were in copyright violation and to essentially make them police it. The other thing that's very problematic is the investor dispute settler provisions. This means that corporations effectively can sue governments for diminished profits. This is a very, and what is so bizarre about this is that this has been tried and failed miserably. Australia, the Australian government should know, because it inserted exactly that provision with, for example, this was actually with Hong Kong, interestingly enough, and this provision actually allows corporations to sue on it. And guess who's suing the Australian government? They're currently in their third year of litigation. And that's, of course, tobacco companies. So the tobacco companies have argued that because in Australia, I don't know if you're familiar, there's some very tight regulations on tobacco advertising. 2 years ago, the Australian government introduced blank. You could only have on your tobacco containers and cartons and so forth images of dying people. You couldn't actually have anything else. Yeah. That's all. So, of course, you know, the various tobacco companies got rather upset. Philip Morris got very upset. They decided to sue the Australian government for lost revenue. And that's still ongoing, and that is because of this type of provision, the investor dispute provision. So what I'd like to do, since I'm wary of the time, is I'd like to just mention a few points about the activism in response to the TPP. Some have argued, in fact, that the TPP, the debates about it, and the discussions surrounding the leaks, if you like, suggest a reinvigoration of the debates about globalization and so on. It's just taken a different form. After 9/11, a lot of those debates seem to wither away. But what has happened since then is a reinvigoration. I can certainly speak of a whole plethora of grassroots organizations that have grown up in response, wanting to discuss the TPP, wanting to discuss the implications of that particular document. I can tell you personally, for example, of certain groups, and interestingly enough, groups that have arisen with a very varied demographic. So, for example, in Melbourne, in Australia, there's a particular well-heeled area called Goldstein, and that particular area has a get-up group that's very active. And that particular get-up group has individuals who want to see the implications of what's in the document. So they've been lobbying the trade minister, Andrew Robb, about the subject, and have asked him for briefings, and he's been very mute about it. He's not particularly interested in discussing the implications of this. Secrecy is fundamental. And in a more physical sense, people have also taken to the streets. I can tell you, for example, in New Zealand in August, it's just last month, there was a considerable number of protests across 21 cities, in fact, and they did number in the thousands. I don't ever want to exaggerate the numbers, but there was a genuine argument about the TPP, and added, of course, to this a plethora of organizations with websites and information. There is certainly discussion about how these particular things are working. So in conclusion and sum, as it were, I'd like to mention some of the points that I've made today. Firstly, we're talking about the mainstream application of what might have been deemed marginal before, namely the use of certain technologies by marginal groups, say the hacktivism aspect, and brought it into a mainstream protest format. And that is a particularly interesting period, and that suggests a sort of redistribution of, at least to a certain extent, power. I can't, of course, say how much in terms of its evaluative sense at this point. We are talking about new brands of engagement, as it were. But ultimately, as I've said before, and I think it's a very important point, the movement here suggests that we should have, and we should take the discussions out of the boardroom, which is where a lot of these things are taking place, and put them in the public sphere where representative government is most importantly represented, namely for the people. And that's the point that I suppose a lot of these ideas I'm discussing today stem from. Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We air on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the World Wide Web at globalresearch.ca. On today's program, we're listening to audio from the Geopolitical Economy Research Group Conference held at the University of Manitoba in September of 2015 on the topic of terror information and state secrecy. Paul Zaremka is professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He's been the general editor for Research in Political Economy since 1977. He was also the editor of the 2008 volume The Hidden History of 9/11. In the presentation which you're about to hear, Zaremka introduces the theme of a paper then under development entitled A Challenge for Geopolitical Economy, September 11th and Conspiracy Theory. Professor Zaremka argues here that the term conspiracy theory is an anti-intellectual concept and makes his point by invoking a few of the problems with the official 9/11 story and lessons from a history before conspiracy theory became a pejorative. So here is Paul Zaremka on the Global Research News Hour.
I know that there are people out there who, you know, label people like myself conspiracy theorists. In a kind of a negative way. I mean, I go back at the beginning to Adam Smith, and I have in my paper a condensation of a short passage in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which I will read. I'll try and read a little bit slowly. It's not too long, so we should be okay. Here he goes. We rarely hear it has been said of the combination of masters, though frequently those of workmen. Now, to stop for a second, combinations here could be conspiracies or unions or whatever. Workmen, of course, would be, you would think of as probably unions. But whoever imagines upon this account that masters rarely combine is as ignorant of the world as of the subject. Masters are always and everywhere in some sort of tacit but constant uniform combination. And then he's now referring to the rise of the, not to have the rise in the ways of wages of labor above their actual rate. Masters too sometimes enter into peculiar combination to sink the wages of labor even below this rate. These are always conducted with the utmost silence and secrecy till the moment of execution. Now, I mean, he doesn't use the word conspiracy theory here or anything like conspiracy. I mean, like the word conspiracy theory, but he does have the concept of conspiracy. So we then could go and examine the next person who I think is probably gets a lot of attention in this conference, and that would be Karl Marx. And he had some very insightful discussion about the coup d'etat in 1853 by the second Napoleon. And that's Louis Napoleon. And that was a very insightful discussion, which at the time people condemned, but later they found out that basically he was an accurate representation of what was going on at that time. And again, you can, he's describing a conspiracy. I mean, some of it is absolutely remarkable, description of the conspiracy that was going on at the time. So I'm trying to say, well, look, Adam Smith, Karl Marx both have done discussions of conspiracy, so we should not be ashamed of working on conspiracy issues. Now, the next thing I want to mention is the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and I'm going to make that in a kind of an interesting context, I think. The Pope was in New York City yesterday giving a speech before the United Nations, and he made a reference to Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., to Thomas Merton, and to the founder of the Catholic Worker, Dorothy, I forgot her last name at the moment, slipped my mind. What's interesting about this is that Thomas Merton basically predicted the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Basically, he said that John F. Kennedy was moving toward peace, and therefore he was subjecting himself to assassination. The book that makes a combination or an interface between Thomas Merton and the John F. Kennedy assassination is this book by James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable, and it has a subtitle, Why He Died and Why It Matters. It's, from my point of view, the first time I read a study of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which convinces me completely that he was in fact assassinated by agents of the United States government, particularly the CIA. He does it, however, he almost proves who did it, but he doesn't even consider that is the main issue. The main issue for him is the fact of what Kennedy stood for and how Kennedy was changing toward promoting international peace. And that's what subjected JFK for the potential for being assassinated. In fact, he was assassinated. an aspect of the book which is important, I think, is that he also describes JFK as a person who had been subject to near death several times in his life, had a lot of personal health problems, and therefore is described as someone who passed beyond the fear of death. And I think that's an important aspect because a lot of discussions about controlling leaders has something to do with being able to blackmail them. And in some sense, James Douglas is arguing that Kennedy was not really subject to blackmail, at least in that dimension. So anyway, I recommend that book by James Douglas. That's two S's at the end, JFK and the Unspeakable. And he connects it to Thomas Merton quite a bit, actually, because he's a Catholic theologian. And I was just struck by the fact that Thomas Merton was one of four people that the Pope brought up yesterday. But he also brought up Martin Luther King Jr., who obviously everybody knows was murdered. And the question is, was he just simply murdered or was he assassinated? Thinking of assassination as when some larger power than such some individual does it. And that is quite an interesting story. The person who confessed to doing it is a man named James Earl Ray. Now, King was assassinated in April of 1968. And after some search and what the things are another, which we could talk about, they apprehended James Earl Ray, and he eventually confessed to it, which allowed him to avoid a trial jury, and was able to be sentenced to life imprisonment, as opposed to the threat of being assassinated. So one can speculate that that had something to do with his confession. I'll make a comment that I was speaking with a prosecutor a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago, and the prosecutor commented that confessions are actually one of the weaker elements of a conviction of a person, because very often confessions really are undertaken for misleading reasons which are not describing the truth of the matter. Anyway, James Earl Ray, 3 days after he arrives in the penitentiary to begin to execute his life sentence, recants his statement that he had murdered Martin Luther King Jr. And basically, for the rest of his life, he fought to be able to have a new trial, which was never successful. However, he had Martin Luther King had a friend who was a lawyer named William Pepper. And Pepper was very much a part of the anti-war movement, which King became in the last year of his life. And he knew King well. And he was shocked, by King's murder, and basically just assumed that James Earl Ray had assassinated King. And that lasted for about 10 years until the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had his suspicions and wanted to interview James Earl Ray and asked William Pepper to go with him, and he did. And to collapse the story a bit, the more they got to know about James Earl Ray and beginning to study the evidence, the more convinced they became that he really did deserve a new trial. There was many attempts being made to be able to get the new trial, which, as I've already said, was never successful, but the end result was that around 1998, actually, it was a couple years before that. In 1996, the King family wanted to help James Earl Ray have a trial. So I think the entire family was on board with this. But in 1998, James Earl Ray died. And so they had to decide what to do. And that became a rather tense decision because you could no longer focus on the person who had been who had confessed and was therefore in jail. But so they changed the question to the conspiracy that was undertaken by the owner of the bar across from the motel where James Earl Ray, where Martin Luther King was assassinated, and other co-conspirators. So then I'm going to put up now the book that resulted from that. This is the An Act of State, which is basically a description of the trial and the after effects of the trial and how to get to the trial that William Pepper undertook as the lawyer for the King's family. They asked only for $100. The issue was not the money, obviously. The issue was to get the truth out. And so you can read the overwhelming evidence that it was a conspiracy and it was not that James Earl Ray had nothing to do with it. And the trial jury had six whites and six blacks, and they convicted, they reached a guilty verdict within 1 hour, and that's both the co-conspirator of the Lloyd Giles, who is the guy, the owner of the bar across from the motel, as well as unnamed government agents, which would include agents of at the national level, state level, and the local level, some of which they kind of know exactly who it was, but they don't know the whole pictures. But anyway, the judge awarded, I think it was 70%, the judge described 70% of the conspiracy as on the part of agents other than the Lloyd Jowers. So what is the importance of that? The importance of that is that here is a trial for conspiracy in part by the United States government against Martin Luther King Jr. And that trial, actually, when I asked people even just last weekend, if somebody who knows a lot of history did not know about that trial. Why? Because almost nobody attended that trial. There was one reporter from Portugal, which has a connection to the trial, who did attend the trial. There was one local reporter who, for a while, lost his job because he attended the trial. And the third person was precisely the same James Douglas I mentioned before, who sat throughout the trial. Those are basically the only three people that sat throughout the trial. And the press didn't cover it. I mean, there was maybe a New York Times mention on page 19 of down at the bottom. You know, that's about it. So it's a quite unknown outcome, but it's a case where you take a conspiratorial situation to a jury trial and get a verdict. So what's my point is I'm again indicating that we should treat, in geopolitical economy, we should treat conspiracy not only as something that happens and we just kind of say it but don't study it, but we actually have to take account. We actually have to take account of the use by the state of conspiracies. And that, of course, then takes us to the issue of September 11th, for which there's a lot of people who are working on it these days. But there's also a lot of people who don't want to hear a thing about the fact that September 11th could have been a conspiracy. The main point I'm trying to drive home is that for this discussion is that we have to take the possibility that the September 11th event was an out-and-out conspiracy, and we can talk about, if we want, who it might have been, and I'm fully prepared to do that, but I'm not going to focus on that today. What I do want to mention is the thing that I want to start with, the thing that gets me the most angry, and that is if you read the 9/11 Commission report, which came out in 2004, there is not a single attempt to prove that any of the hijackers are on the plane. They simply state they basically assume their conclusion and go on from there. They don't even say where they got the names from, although they would probably say they got it from the FBI. So September 11th, for me, got me most angry. I will say I didn't react immediately. This took me about a half a year before I got involved. But my sense of justice requires that if you're going to convict people and you're going to start a whole perspective of how the world should change as a result of what happened on September 11th, you ought to have a totally convincing case about who the perpetrators were. And the 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention it, didn't even talk about it, okay? They just assumed that these 19 people did what was said that they did. And there are some cases where I could talk, for example, I could talk, and I do in my paper, about one individual named Jara, who was in charge of the alleged pilot of the plane United Airlines 93. I so happen to have heard a video of his uncle in Lebanon. Okay, while he was a Muslim, he actually went to a Catholic university, and he was not religious particularly. I heard an interview of his uncle who just said that in his family, of course, if you hear that somebody in your family does something so horrible as that, of course you're going to spend a lot of time trying to digest it and trying to understand if it could possibly have happened. Anyway, the family came to the conclusion, no, he might have been on the plane, but he certainly would not be a person who would ever do something like that. So the first point I want to make is that if you're going to convict 19 alleged hijackers of doing something, then you ought to have a real proof for it, and the government did not even attempt to offer a proof. So that's an opening. Now, as an economist, I also studied insider trading before 9/11, and I will skip to that and then come back to some other issues. Before 9/11, there was events called put option trading in both American Airlines and United Airlines. And those are the two planes, airline companies which were involved. Basically, there was a large increase in put option trades on both those airlines. Now, put option trade means that sometime in a defined future, but at any time that the stock market is open, you can sell that stock at whatever the price is that you have contracted for. You can sell at whatever price you contracted for. So, for example, those two airlines had stock prices coincidentally around $30 on that day. And before that day. And if you put a put option at $30 for, let's say, the next month and a half, which is, by the way, more or less what happened, for the next month and a half, and the stock price falls, you can still sell the stock at $30. That's what a put option allows you to do. And what in fact happened is that both those stocks went down to about $17 or $18 in the follow-up to the September 11th attacks. And the consequence was that anybody who had put a put option could sell those stocks for $30 after they buy them for $18, $19, $17. It cost you a little bit of money to buy the put option, but it might be a half a dollar, it might be a dollar. So you can make quite a bit of money if you know ahead of time what's going to happen. And there is not just those two airlines, but other airline stocks and other financial stocks, all of which had increase in put options. Now, one could say, well, okay, fine. But there have been three academic studies, all now published, one of which is in the Journal of Business, which nobody can accuse of as being anything other than a mainstream financial publication, and two other publications, one of which just was published within the last month, okay, all of which in their different ways come to the same conclusion, that there was substantial put option trading that it occurred before September 11th. What that means? That means that there were people who knew it ahead of time and were taking advantage of the upcoming event. And when you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they just have one paragraph and one footnote about what actually became a mainstream article for about 1 month after September 11th. I think the people those data are publicly available data. I think the people who are making comments did not know where it was leading. They thought it would lead to Osama bin Laden. And I think there was somehow a put down of the whole discussion once it was realized that it wasn't going to lead to Osama bin Laden. I would make a comment here that, I mean, I've done enough similar economic research to know that when you have a controversial conclusion like this, namely put option, taking advantage of put options before September 11th, that there would be other people writing articles which would contest that conclusion. In this particular case, there has been nobody, which is no academics that I have seen, who have contested these findings. And I don't think that means that it couldn't be done. I think it means that people are so scared of even talking about it that they don't even want to look, that they don't even want to consider that if they did the research, they might confirm rather than disconfirm the results. In other words, I'm suggesting that there is a fear inside the academe to arrive at such conclusions. Okay, so that's the second point I want to make about September 11th. The one that's getting a lot of attention is that there was not just two skyscrapers that fell on that day, and that was the World Trade Center 1 and 2, which has been shown over and over and over and over and over and over again. There was also a third building, the World Trade Center 7, which collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. All three collapses look like a normal controlled demolition. What does that mean? If the buildings had been hit by an airplane and that actually caused the building to collapse, it would have been done in a way which weakened the side of the building in which the planes came in, and more so than elsewhere. And you would have expected the buildings to tilt over rather than go straight down. And if it had been done by a gathering fire in the building, you would expect the building to slowly sort of come down. But in fact, all three of these buildings came down more or less at the fall of gravity, a little bit slower than the fall of gravity, but we're just talking about like seconds. How much more time do you want me to take?
5 minutes, please.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
So, for example, the two World Trade Centers came down in about 12.7 seconds, and the World Trade Center 7, which was a 47-story building, came down within, I think, 9 seconds. Which is almost the fall of gravity, which suggests what? It suggests that the underpinnings of all three of those buildings somehow had gotten rid of and forced the building to simply collapse, and it collapsed on its own footprint, which is the dramatic part of it. It's what a controlled demolition does when you want to bring down a building. We don't yet know. I mean, some people think they know. I don't know exactly how it was done. I mean, we do know that the 9/11 Commission report and then the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which was supposed to be investigating all these buildings, they did not test for whether there was explosive materials in the dust down from that came down the building. I happen to personally know a woman who survived in an apartment building across the World Trade Center, who did collect dust and handed the dust over to a physicist who did analyze and did find that there was explosive materials in the dust. But the 9/11 commission report, nor the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, ever investigated on their own whether there was explosive materials in the dust. We also have the issue of the Pentagon, and I think we just have a bit too little time for me to describe in detail. But let me just say that there are eyewitnesses. I mean, a considerable number of eyewitnesses who were in a position to actually see how the plane came in, and it did not come in toward the Pentagon from the direction that the 9/11 Commission report describes. And in fact, that suggests that the plane itself was not responsible for whatever happened at the Pentagon, that it could have been a explosives preset in the Pentagon or perhaps a cruise missile that went into the Pentagon, not an American Airlines Flight 77, as was described. There's also issues about phone calls from the planes. It actually is impossible at that time, and even now it's difficult, to use cell phones from higher than 2,000 feet. A lot of the initial news reports claims that people on the planes were making phone calls, even at 35,000 feet from a cell phone. When you finally got to the trial of Moussaoui in 2006, the government had backtracked on that and said only that the cell phone calls are made when the planes are close to the ground. And that meant that all the other calls had to be made from air phones. But then there's the issue about some of those planes didn't have air phones in the back of the seats. So that's a whole issue we could discuss in greater detail. We also have the issue of what actually happened in the Pentagon. I mean, not the Pentagon, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. And there's people who say that they saw that the plane was shot down, which actually would not be unreasonable to shoot down the plane. Given if every of the other three events were correctly described, you would expect that, you know, if there's a real conspiracy to bring down the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon, you would think you'd want to protect whatever the other plane was going to do. But anyway, the government claimed no, that it was taken over.
That was Paul Zaremka speaking at the September 2015 Geopolitical Research Group Conference in Winnipeg on A Challenge for Geopolitical Economy, September 11th, and Conspiracy Theory. For more information on the Geopolitical Economy Research Group and the September 2015 conference, please visit the website gergconference.ca. You've been listening to Global Research News Hour in the summer. You can download our shows from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on our program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch.